false alarm.
Sorry. Practicing. There's only about 16 buttons I got to hit before we start the meeting.
Okay, I'm going to call the Fish and Game Commission meeting to order. My name is Jim Kellogg. I'm president of the commission from Concord. On my right is Commissioner Richard Rogers from Santa Monica, and from Carpinteria, and right of him is Bob Hatoy, commissioner from Santa Monica. On my left is our executive director, Bob Trainer, and left of him is Commissioner Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City. Also with us today is a Chief Deputy Director for the Department, Paul Stein, Deputy Director Sankey Mastra, and Deputy Director Greg Hunter. We have with us the Chief of Enforcement, Nancy Foley, and Warden Zeke Aubrey. Thank you for being here. We also have Don Cook, the District Director. Don, there he is. And I think you didn't mark these guys. Okay, John Fisher, our deputy director for the commission, and Sherry Cole, and our legal counsel, Bill Cunningham from the AG's office. With that, I'll turn it over to the director for item number one on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. President. Our first item is announcement of the results from the executive session, and your legal counsel, Mr. Cunningham, will be making this report.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the Commission, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, and your legal counsel. I'd like to report that yesterday afternoon the Commission met in executive session. This is a closed session conducted pursuant to Government Code Section 11-126, which allows the Commission to meet with its lawyers and counsel to discuss matters in litigation. Also, we can meet to discuss matters regarding resolution of permit appeals and license appeals. I'd like to report that the following action was taken. There was a consideration of a variety of license and permit items, and the following permits or licenses were granted: the request of Larry Moore for a deeper nearshore fisheries permit, the request of Ernest Pagan for a transferable market squid light boat permit, and the request of Gregory Reel for a transferable market squid light boat permit. All of those were granted. The requests and appeals of Robert Ash, Gordon Daly, Jonathan Smith, and Daniel Williams were denied. And that's all I have to report. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Cunningham. Item two is public forum. This item, the Commission allocates up to 30 minutes to receive public comments on issues that are not on the agenda. The Commission requests that you try to keep your comments limited to 3 minutes per person. And at that time, the Commission has the ability to schedule that issue for a future Commission meeting and or request the Department to provide a response either now or at a future meeting. Our first speaker will be Jack Hansen, who's supervisor from Lassen County, followed by Walt Manziel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing your commission up here and holding your meeting here in Lassen County. We're honored to have you here. My name is Jack Hansen. I'm a rancher. I have a family cow-calf operation a little bit north of town up in the Willow Creek Valley here. And I'm also the elected supervisor representing District 5, which is the easterlymost district here in Lassen County. As you probably are aware, just a real quick briefing on Lassen County, if you will. Again, we're honored to have you here today. We're a county of about 34,000 folks. Of those 33 or 34,000 in population, however, about 8 or 9,000 are incarcerated out in the state facilities that are east of town. So actually, the population of Lassen County is about 25,000. You probably saw the population sign on Susanville that showed 17,000. Again, subtract those folks out of that population, you'll find out what actually lives in the city of Susanville. Susanville is the only incorporated city in Lassen County. And as you're probably aware, right here where we're sitting is actually kind of interesting. The Sierra Nevadas come from the south and stop here right at the Diamond Mountains, and the Cascade Mountains come down from the north. So we have the Sierra Nevadas and the Cascades meeting here, and then, of course, the Great Basin. About two-thirds of the county is Great Basin. We have the Lassen National Forest, Eagle Lake Resource Area for the BLM. So we've got a Forest Service, a National Forest is headquartered here, and also an area for the BLM. I think that we have an excellent Fish and Game, local Fish and Game Commission. We have a very active, interested population of folks out here that are very interested in the wildlife, both for hunting and fishing and enjoyment. Couple of the issues that you'll find up in Lassen County that may be of interest to the commission members in the future. While we don't have the development pressures that you may see in the areas to the west of here, we do have those pressures that are coming in and building into these habitat areas, critical habitat areas for much of the wildlife that resides here. And so I think that our county, as well as other counties in California and other populations in California, is challenged to balance these needs, the need for development of property and the need for wildlife habitat. And our local commission is involved in that. Your local biologists with the Department of Fish and Game are heavily involved in it. We always appreciate their input. One of the things that I would suggest that one of the most notable efforts that we've seen recently in Lassen County is the culmination of our conservation strategy for the sage-grouse. As you may know, up in this corner of the state, as well as down south of here, down in Mono County and Inyo County, we've had real issues in the potential listing of the sage-grouse, which I think would have been a great challenge for our county and this area as a whole. But through good collaboration and cooperative effort between the wildlife folks, the Bureau of Land Management especially, and the Department of Fish and Game, along with permittees and ranchers and other landowners, and then the county also as a party to that, we put together a conservation strategy that I think is going to prove very successful in the future for the sage-grouse. But again, I just want to welcome you, and thank you very much for thank you very much for holding your meeting here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Supervisor. Walt Manziel, followed by Joe Musa.
President Kellogg, members of the Commission, my name is Walt Manziel, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. Over the last couple of years, your commission has addressed many important issues wherein the continuing and ongoing conflict between hunters and those who oppose all hunting has manifested itself. To date, your commission has generally found, at least partially, in favor with the hunter's side of the issue, and for this we sincerely thank you. However, on several important issues, only a short-term or temporary solution has been reached. Questions such as whether or not hunters will be able to continue to use bullets and shot containing lead for any type of hunting anywhere in California, or, on a more local basis, whether or not hunters so inclined will be able to continue to pursue and sometimes harvest brant on Morro Bay, will come back before you in the not-too-distant future. Always, the proponents of the anti-hunting point of view will couch their proposals as a reasonable compromise or as a step really needed to protect this or that particular species. They will almost always state something to the effect that right-thinking and ethical hunters will support this because they will clearly see the need, clearly implying those of us who question their point of view are less than ethical and clear-thinking. If you examine their proposals carefully, you will see their reasonable compromise amounts to a gain for their side and a loss for hunters. Such steps will continue in one direction until we hunters are no more if the anti-hunters have their way. Each time we move, even a little bit, in their direction, a few more hunters give up the sport and take up other forms of recreation. A few more dollars are lost to the DFG budget. A few more cuts are made to this or that DFG program. Virtually never do these anti-hunting groups propose any major funding donations to help finance their compromise. Virtually never will they pay to fund the field positions in the DFG, which will be needed to support their proposal, or even to admit such additional personnel will be needed. As you look at these proposals in the future, please examine closely the underlying motives of those making the proposal. Always remember, your commission and the field personnel of the DFG really constitute the first and last lines of defense against the anti-hunting factions. We, as reasonable, ethical, and knowledgeable sportsmen and women, will support you in every way we can to ensure a sound and viable future for the hunting and shooting sports. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
Joe Musa, I believe, followed by Lynn Griswold.
Hello, I'm representing Plumas County Fish and Game Commission. And what we're trying to do, we sent a letter to a Mr. Turner of the commission. We'd like to change the regulations on the tributaries running into Antelope Lake. And the letter that I presented to you will give you the explanation for it. This is one of the only lakes in Plumas County that the tributaries are not opened on the 15th, on the last week of April. We'd like to change it to the last week of May. I also have a letter from the Game Wardens Association that also approves this recommendation. And here's a letter. You might pass it to Dan Nicholson. We'd like to change it to the rest, to the same as the rest of the lakes in Plumas County. We'd like to change it to the last week of May. And that's all I can, that's about it.
Any comments or questions? Thank you.
Just a note, the commission will be considering its review of all sport fishing regulations beginning with its August 2006 meeting, and so this will be incorporated as part of the public recommendations.
Thank you.
Lynn Griswold, followed by Paul Weakland.
Good morning. I'm Len Griswold, and thank you guys for being here, all you folks. I'm representing a friend of mine, Mark Paul. Is it okay if I speak in the first person, because he wrote this out? Dear members of the California Fish and Game Commission, first I would like to thank you for your service to the sportsmen of the state of California and the residents of Lassen County. I would also like to thank you for your appearance today for public comment. I have been a guide outfitter for years in California and elsewhere. It has been quite difficult and in many instances impossible for outfitters to obtain drawing results of successful applicants in our state drawing process for tags such as X-Zone deer, antelope, elk, sheep, sage hen, and purchasers of California bear tags. Several years ago, I submitted to our local Fish and Game Commission and to members of the California Fish and Game Department this proposal. They all agreed and showed strong interest with it. When we followed up on this, no one had made any effort to pursue this. I had planned to travel to one of your meetings down below in the near future, but your presence today has helped a lot. My proposal is very simple. Knowing of the Privacy Act, which is in effect in California, the Fish and Game Department cannot release the names of yearly successful applicants of the prior mentioned tags. Several other states have similar privacy laws. When applicants in these states apply for tags, there is a simple box for the applicant to mark, giving authorization for their names and addresses to be released to certain individuals, such as guide outfitters. I have enclosed two sample applications coming from the state of Colorado. These particular applications are for moose and elk, but can be marked for any and all species. I have circled the box to be marked on the applications. It would be a great service to our state sportsmen, giving them the opportunity in receiving literature from individuals that could assist them in the pursuit of a successful hunt. It would also provide guides the opportunity to get the word out that there are outfitters in California that most sportsmen no longer realize exist. This would also be an opportunity for the Fish and Game Department to obtain some much-needed extra revenue paid for by guides interested in signing on to this program, within reason. A second alternative would be for guides to pay for the Department of Fish and Game for placing the guides and advertisements in specifically indicated tag packets when mailed by the Department of Fish and Game to successful sportsmen drawing that tag. Please give these proposals strong consideration, especially the first one, as many California guide outfits have recently folded up and many more will close in the near future. If agreed upon by the Commission, hopefully this could be available to sportsmen for the 2006 application process available in April via the Big Game Tag Application Booklet. Please feel free in contacting Mark at any time, and he would be more than happy to assist you in any way possible. And that's Mark Paul, guide outfitter, who had something personal come up and he couldn't make it today, and he apologized.
Well, thank you for representing him. Shonky, is there anything you'd like to comment about on that?
Yeah.
Push that button on the...
That's on. Yeah, this is an issue that's come up in the past. We're actually interested in providing that kind of a service. Unfortunately, that proposal has been kind of caught up in the whole the Automated License Data System program. What we do provide now is advertising space and guide lists to hunters interested in guides. Those who want a guide can request, and we provide them the complete list of guides, so they have access. This would make it a little easier. There is a privacy issue, but this kind of a checkoff could work. It just the technical aspects, we're kind of waiting for the ALDS system to implement, but we like the idea. But hunters currently do have access to all the guides. They just have to ask us, and it's also on our website. The list.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, ma'am.
Yeah.
Sankey, is there any current update on the ALS?
For what it's worth.
Yes, we put out RFPs. The department's currently refining proposals with, I think there's four remaining entities that are negotiating with us on delivering ALDS. We're currently in the process of trying to seek authority to actually implement. There's some outstanding legal language we need to get on the books to make it work, mostly with a collection of fees like the park reservation system. We think it's a pretty simple step, actually, so we're not too worried. Our biggest concern is a budget, how that slows things down maybe. But we are still pursuing, we are still moving forward, and the key thing is we're getting some vendors who are really working on it, and I don't think we're far off from having a viable package, and then it's just implementing.
Really glad to hear that. As we're all aware, that's a wonderful service for the people of the state of California, but for visiting fishermen and visiting hunters, it just facilitates things so dramatically.
Right. I mean, it'd be a great boost to convenience, visiting.
Yeah, you can
fishermen.
Fly in. You can fly in the afternoon after the store is closed, where you can get your licenses and be in your guide boat the next morning.
Oh, absolutely! And both the director and the resource secretary support the idea. Which
I'm sure do we.
Yes.
Thank you,
Paul. Did you want to make?
I just wanted to add an additional comment here. Under Director Broderick's leadership, we have an education and outreach program that will also work very well in addressing this issue. So we'll be bringing more on that as time goes by, but it's a newly created program, and it will dovetail very well with this subject.
Okay, Paul.
Mr. Weakland, followed by Buck Parks.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. One of the things that the speaker forgot to say about Susanville, it is a very unique community here, for it has one of the three gunsmithing schools in the United States. I lived here for 3 years and went through the program. It's outstanding, and I think that everyone should visit the facility while they're here because it is a very unique situation. I would like to be here today to talk about commercial fishing laws. Abalone is on the agenda, so I will wait until later to make my comments on abalone. Right now, I would like you to take your attention and look at the handout that I gave to you. We have been talking turbid snails for years and years and years. We have given many meetings, what do you call them? Interviews, whatever it is, with Fish and Game, and specifically Ian Taniguchi. Now, the handout that I gave you will point out the fact that it has been over 4 years now, and still misprints are being purposely continued in the commercial fish laws, in particular the entitled vertebrate permit. Now, when the abalones were outlawed, a lot of us turned to turbid snails. But Ian Taniguchi, in his deceitful, conniving, deliberate manner, has continually typographical error on the species that you're allowed to take under entitled vertebrate permit. As you will notice, continuing, he and John Ugrit seem to be a conspiracy not to follow the law. And they have used, what do they call it? Oh, human error to continue these typographical errors. In California, we only have one type of sand dollar that is harvested, the eccentric sand dollar. But they continually put two on the list to leave out turbid snails. I would like this to be corrected. This demonstrates a continuing failure of your Marine Resources Division. And why is this continuing after so many years?
We will relay your opinion to the department for you, Paul.
If I have a few more minutes, I'd like to talk about abalone. This abalone draft recovery plan, number nine.
Paul, we'll have it on the agenda.
You can do that later. Thank you. Mr. Parks.
Yeah, first off, I'd like to thank the commission for holding their meeting up here in Lassen County today. There's several people up here that appreciate seeing meetings like this being held in this portion of the state. As usual, they seem to be a long ways away. My name is Buck Parks, and I'm here representing the Lassen County Fish and Game Commission. And the commission works on several issues, whether it be local, state, and national. We meet once a month here in Lassen County, some of us coming from long ways, long distance in the county. And we take pride in taking part in fish and game issues and passing whatever recommendations we see fit along to you. One thing that has come up recently has been the an issue regarding the private lands wildlife management Section 601 programs. Historically, these programs have been limited to no more than 10% of the total buck take and total antelope also in each zone, 10%. These programs have proven to be a workable and reasonable method to allocate these resources. Seems like maybe recently there's been kind of a issue that came up to possibly change these allocations. The commission recently passed a resolution that then went on to the Lassen County Board of Supervisors, and they also passed a resolution regarding this 10% take. And basically, to kind of summarize, we would like to see this allocation maximum 10% on the PLM and maximum 10% on the late tags to continue for pronghorn antelope and deer harvest within each tag zone in northeastern California, with no change to the landowner Section 554 tag distribution. We see that, you know, we feel that these are very reasonable allocations. When you start looking at numbers where you have some deer hunts in northeastern California have at least five applicants for each tag, and some have 20 or more applicants for each tag. And on some antelope hunts in this part of the state, you have 50 or more applicants per antelope tag. So you have to realize that when you take 10% and you give that to the private land management hunts or the late hunts, if you start increasing that percentage any, then you start taking away from the 90% that goes to the general public. And so that's one of our main concerns. And that, and there's some other, you know, issues going on up here that you might not know about that you don't see in the rest of the state. There's a big move in this part of the area to work on sagebrush steppe ecosystem restoration, and it's through juniper management up in this part of the state. And it has the juniper issue in this part of the state has had a pretty serious effect on a lot of our wildlife, and of course mainly talking big game, antelope, deer, and we have a lot of ecosystems out there that are getting decadent and kind of getting overgrown with these junipers. And the Forest Service and the BLM have got a pretty good program in place. They're trying to get on the ground, get running to address some of these issues. And I'd like to see the Fish and Game Commission as well as the department take a very supportive role in this program in improving our wildlife habitat up here, because habitat, as a lot of us know, is the most important thing for our wildlife. And so anytime we can get a positive effect out there on the ground, it's a lot better for wildlife and a lot better for the public in an indirect way. So thanks again for the opportunity to comment. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you for sharing with us, Saki.
I would just like to briefly make note of this. This is a historical event. Those of you who aren't familiar with the history of the PLM program, the Private Lands Management Program, started in the 80s. This was war for almost two decades. This was a very controversial program when it started, and to have the Lassen County Fish and Game Commission come in and support the program is, I'm pinching myself. I mean, we've come a long ways, and this is actually quite significant, and I'm very impressed that, you know, the region working with the locals have finally gotten a common understanding of the benefits and the values of the program and to the hunting public at large. So, I mean, this is big for us. Having personally been involved in those PLM wars over the last two decades, I'm really impressed and thankful to the county for being supportive now, because we can now really make some progress with and focus on positive steps. And this is significant. I mean, we've been sued and all kinds of things over the past. And may not sound like a lot, but this is big, given our history with us.
So thanks again to the Lassen County Fish and Game Committee.
That's all the speaker cards I have for this item, commissioners. We'll move to item 3. And this item is pursuant to section 2074.2 of the Fish and Game Code, a consideration of the department's petition and recommendation to delist the Siskiyou Mountain Salamander as a threatened species. Commissioners has a copy of the department's petition on this matter, as well as two letters that have been submitted in opposition to the department's petition. One from Hart Welsh, and also one from the Center for Biological Diversity. Both have been sent to you via email, and we also have a hard copy of the Center of Biological Diversity's letter, which we provided to you this morning. Mr. Mark Stouffer will be making the department's presentation.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission. My privilege to be before you this morning to give you a short presentation on the petition that you accepted for consideration last month. I'm joined today by Jennifer Bull and Steve Burton in the back of the room here. These are scientists with the Department of Fish and Game out of our Wairika office. They have been a very important part of developing the status review for the species and also the petition. They have considerable experience with field work. And they're here basically to help me out if you have questions that require their particular expertise. Well, as you know, you have a delisting petition in front of you. This is a little washed-out picture in this lighting of the Siskiyou Mountain Salamander. I want to express appreciation to Stu Farber from Timber Products Company for sharing this photograph with us. I also have included a photograph of the Scott Barr salamander, a related species immediately south of the distribution of Siskiyou Mountain salamander. The reason I included this, there are two reasons. One is I have a quarter in this picture, and it helps you get a sense of the scale and size of the animal. And secondly, just until recently, the department considered the Scott Barr salamander and the Siskiyou Mountain salamander to be the same species. Recent publication proposed that the Scott Barr salamander be split off, and the petition was revised to reflect the actual range for the Siskiyou Mountain salamander. A regulatory history here. The species was first discovered in 1963, And it was described in the scientific literature in 1965 as a brand new species. In 1971, the Fish and Game Commission identified and listed the species as rare. At that time, under the Endangered Species Act, the commission had two choices. They had the choice of rare or endangered. Threatened was not an option that was available to the commission at that time. At the time of the listing in 1971, the species was known in California from 8 locations and an additional 7 locations in Oregon. And the known range describing those locations in California was all in Siskiyou County and it encompassed 6 square miles. In 1971, the definition for rare is presented here. And it's in actuality very similar to the current definition for threatened. It was a species of birds, mammals, fish, amphibians, or reptiles that, although not presently threatened with extinction, is in such small numbers throughout its range that it may be endangered if its environment worsens. Maybe worth keeping in mind what this says, and that is that in 1971, when the range was 6 miles, and there were 8 sites in California, the commission's finding was that, under that information, it was not threatened with extinction. This is a map of Siskiyou County. It's a nested set of maps. On the bottom left, you can see Siskiyou County highlighted. Above that, zeroes in with a red square to give you an idea of the location within Siskiyou County where you can find the species. And on the right, in the larger map, that blue crosshatched area represents the 6 square miles that were understood and known to be the range for the species in 1971. Since that listing, a couple of things have happened that are relevant to your deliberations. In 1985, for animals, the term rare was no longer an option, and all animals that had been listed as rare were grandfathered into a category known as threatened. For animals in California now, we have either threatened or endangered. We do not have the category for rare. The Department of Fish and Game in 1987 performed a status review, and based upon the information that we had at that time, we recommended that the threatened status be retained. In the mid to late 90s, we initiated an additional status review, a more in-depth review. The 1987 review was not based upon any additional field work. It was simply a review of the information that was available to the department at that time. In the late 90s, we initiated a more in-depth status review because of several observations. Several things started to become apparent to us. One is that the number of documented occurrences had grown substantially. Secondly, the range had within which those occurrences has been found is much greater than the original 6 square miles. Next, we started finding salamanders on disturbed sites, and by that I mean sites that were either disturbed by timber harvesting, or disturbed by mining, or disturbed by roads, and in fact, all three of those. And it seems like I could have done a better job in the last bullet here. What I meant to say, under presence of, I guess that's correct. On these disturbed sites, we have also been finding all life stages, and we typically refer to those as juveniles, subadults, and adults, based upon the size of the animals. And I would also add that on these disturbed sites, we have found gravid, that is, pregnant female salamanders. So it would indicate to us that even on these sites that had been disturbed, that perhaps they were not being extirpated or from those locations as we had thought they might have been. Current status in California, the range for the species as we understand it now, it covers at least 277 square miles, as contrasted with the 6 square miles we understood in 1971. There are 224 documented occurrences, as opposed to the 8 that we had in 1971. Pardon me? Yes. And they occur in a wide range of habitat types within that range. Now, I do want to make a caveat here. They're not distributed evenly over that range. Typically, they're found in rocky talus habitats, and certainly the whole range is not covered with rocky talus habitat. Within that 277 square miles, about 10% of that is in private ownership, mostly commercial timberlands. About 90% are in federal ownership. Of that range, about 14% are in federal matrix lands, which means that those lands are available for program timber harvesting on federal land. About 76% of that range, the 277 square miles, is in what is now classified as either late serial reserves or wilderness areas. There will not be any timber harvest or activity in wilderness areas. There may be, in some cases, activity in late serial reserves where it would achieve the purposes of getting to a late serial reserve. This map illustrates, with a red line, the current known range, as opposed to the cross-hatched area at the top of the map, which shows the range as it was understood in 1971. The red dots are documented occurrences. If you took the time to count those dots, you might not find 224, but based upon the scale of the map, that's because there's some overlap. They disappear in the clutter. Also in this map, this is within the petition that you have.
Private lands are of this color, and the rest of it would be pretty much federal land. Matrix lands are kind of this lighter pink color, which would be like right here. Fortunately, the petition has a map, so we'll be here for you.
In the mid-90s, as we began working with timber companies on applications for incidental take associated with their operations, the information that we had at that time can be characterized, I think, with these following hypotheses. First of all, they were only present at a very few locations. Second, that they were restricted to a small range in California. Third, that you didn't find them above 4,500 feet, even within the range. Fourth, that they were restricted to late serial or old growth forests. Next, that you find them only at cool, moist sites. Usually a cool, moist site would be characterized by some of the things that are listed here. North-facing slopes, very dense overstory canopy, and undisturbed ground so that the understory canopy was not very disturbed either. And finally, that they're adversely affected or extirpated by timber harvesting, road building, and mining. So that if the understanding we had then is that if these activities occurred, at the very least, the number of animals there would be greatly reduced, and most likely they would disappear from that site. And since they don't move very much, for a Siskiyou Mountain salamander, for one to move from me to you would be the biggest trip of a lifetime, pretty much. The concern was once extirpated from the site, they would not be likely to recolonize the site and recover. This is the information that we believe to be the best available information as we commenced talking with timber harvest companies about whether or not we could authorize incidental take or not.
Is that still the case that they're not found above 4,500 feet?
No, it's not.
That's what I thought.
So just to apply some information relative to some of these hypotheses that we believe to be operative in the mid-90s. The first one, that they're present only in a very few sites. Well, there are at least 224 documented occurrences in California, and this is a very difficult species to find. It would be irresponsible to really to think that that's all there are. Approximately 32% of the known sites are on private land, and approximately 68% of known sites on public land. You might remember that these numbers seem different than what I just showed you. I said that 10% of the range is in private land, and 90% of the range is in federal land. The reason for the discrepancy is that, frankly, private lands are better investigated than are the federal lands. So they have looked harder on private lands and found more. The reason for that is the Department of Fish and Game has required timber companies, in association with the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, where we believe suitable habitat to be present, to conduct surveys. And this is one example of when you survey, you find things. Hypothesis, a very small range distribution in California. Well, 277 square miles is, in fact, not very much of California. And in this group of salamanders, known as what we call the plethodontid salamanders, this is a fairly small home range. It's the second smallest home range. You may see, as you read the letter from the Center for Biological Diversity, it's a little confusing because at one point they say this is the smallest, and then later they say Scott Barr salamander is the smallest. The reality is the Scott Barr salamander has a smaller range than this species, but this would be smaller than some other plethodontid salamanders. Still, it's quite a lot larger than the 6 square miles the commission understood 34 years ago. The hypothesis present only below 4,500 feet elevation. In California, we now know that from locations slightly above 5,900 feet, and in Oregon, there is at least one location above 6,000 feet. High elevations are probably not as good a habitat for the species because they have longer cold periods, and these are cold-blooded animals. But there are probably more locations above this elevation. Once you get above 4,000 feet, it gets real hard to find them because the ground's covered with snow. I mean, the window of opportunity to find them is very, very narrow. These animals are rarely active above the surface, and only then, when the humidity is right, when the temperatures are right, and often only a very short period of time. So when you have the right conditions, you get in the trucks and you go look for them right now because tomorrow won't work. A hypothesis that they're restricted to late cereal forests with dense overstory canopy. Now, in 2003, the Department of Fish and Game, we sent our staff out to try to find every site that we could locate that we knew there were salamanders at. And we visited 93 locations that have been documented for Siskiyou Mountain salamander. Turns out that now some of those sites are Scott Barr salamander, which are very similar. So this data reflects all 93 sites and lumps together the Scott Barr salamander data with the Siskiyou Mountain salamander data. As the bullet says, these are actually found in many habitat types. And you may know that the Department of Fish and Game has a system called the Wildlife Habitat Relationship System that classifies vegetation in various sizes of trees and canopy. If there's a D up there, that means it's a dense canopy. If it's an S, it means sparse canopy. If it's an M, it means moderate canopy.
Sir, could I have you speak to the microphone?
Sure. Sorry. At the left-hand side of the graph, size class 1 would essentially be a clear cut, or an open area with no overstory vegetation at all. On the far right, size class 6 would be trees of approximately 24 inches in diameter and larger, an old-growth forest, essentially. So you can see that we have documented their presence, at least, in visiting these sites where they were known. At a wide range of habitat types. They're not restricted to late cereal forest habitat, which would be anything from 4D through 5M through 6D. Excuse me for the this is a little esoteric, but it's relevant to our in the support of our decision here. (Clears throat) and out of order. Inspected 92 sites where we knew, okay, I already said this, 87% of the sites, by the way, were on private lands. Principally, this would be was because the private landowners had better data on exactly where they found the salamanders than we were able to get from the federal land managers. And when we got there, we documented, we looked for salamanders, we documented habitat conditions, the substrate conditions, that is the talus or and disturbance. This is an example of a site in Siskiyou County where we found, I believe, Jennifer, juveniles, subadults, and adults. This is, I believe the photo is taken from the spot where the salamander was found. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and these are the four quadrants. This would be, I believe, northeast, southeast, southwest, and northwest.
And I believe it was northeast.
Okay. The four directions, looking around from where the salamander was found. We included this as an example of a site that is not old growth, has never been old growth, and it has all life stages of this salamander. Another example, similar conditions, not old growth, not late cereal, never has been, probably won't be based upon the substrate here. And here again we found juveniles, subadults, and adults. And a gravid female, too? Or is that the next slide?
Next slide.
Okay. The next slide is actually a site that had been documented as Siskiyou Mountain Salamander. It's actually Scott Barr Salamander. Same sort of thing. These are, I'm not saying that you don't find them in late cereal habitats or old growth, but the assumption that they're only found in those habitats, we don't think is valid. And this is another illustration of that. The hypothesis that you find them only at cool, moist sites, principally those that are facing north, because they would not be exposed to the sun as much. Well, of these 92 sites, in fact, 38% of them did have a northern exposure. 28% had a southern exposure. 20%, I'm sorry, the colors here are washed out. Western exposure, 20% southern and 14% eastern. This is not a random sampling of all habitat types, and it isn't intended necessarily to represent for the universe of where you're going to find salamanders the exposures. Instead, what it does say, though, is that you can find them on any exposure if the habitat conditions are right. In particular, the rocky talus, which is you're looking for. The hypothesis that you only find them on sites that haven't been disturbed. This indicates, in looking at the four quadrants, so if on the right-hand side, zero would be, zero quadrants mean you didn't find any disturbance. One would mean you found disturbance in one quadrant, two, and so on. So in 31% of the plots, there was no evidence of ground disturbance. In 16% of the plots, there was evidence of more than 75% of the soil was disturbed. In 21%, more than half of the soil was disturbed, and so on. So we were finding them in sites that were undisturbed as well as those that were. The hypothesis is that they're adversely affected or extirpated by timber harvesting, road building, and mining. Well, this data shows that for the different categories of disturbance that we were looking for, landslides, mining, roads, skid trails, fire, timber harvest before 1974, when the forest practice rules changed and became more protective, and timber harvest after 1974, the data on here shows that we didn't find very many sites where Siskiyou Mountain salamander were documented, where we found evidence of landslide or mining. As you get over to roads, skid trails, fire, timber harvest, we found quite a few sites that had been disturbed by those kinds of activities, yet salamanders had been documented post that kind of disturbance. It's probably worth saying that, as you know, the Endangered Species Act prohibits take of a listed species on private ground. Well, at one time, we thought there were only about 6 square miles of this species, and we were focusing on that area. As occurrences became documented, that zone that we were looking at expanded. and it came to include some areas that had been disturbed before we knew there were salamanders there. So that answers the question as to, well, why was there timber harvest in a place where there were salamanders? And the reason is because we didn't know they were there at the time the timber harvesting went on, or it was on federal ground and take wasn't prohibited. Outstanding issues. And I'll go through each of these briefly. Petition, litigation for a federal listing, the status of the available information, scientific review and disagreement, and monitoring. Thought it might be useful to go through these for you. In June of 2004, a number of petitioners, including the Center for Biological Diversity, proposed to the federal government that the Siskiyou Mountain salamander be listed as a federally threatened or endangered species. Under the federal ESA, the Fish and Wildlife Service must look at these five factors in order before making a finding as to the merits of that petition. These are the present or threatened destruction, modification, or curtailment of habitat and range. So, a little bit in terms of what are the risks to the species. They have to look at whether or not the species is being overutilized for commercial, recreational, scientific, or educational purposes. Whether disease or predation is a factor, whether existing regulatory mechanisms are inadequate, and finally, anything else that may be affecting the existence of the species. The Fish and Wildlife Service at that time made a finding that the listing wasn't warranted. Center for Biological Diversity has filed a lawsuit against the federal government alleging that they missed their regulatory deadlines in order to make their findings. And it's our understanding from the staff level that the Fish and Wildlife Service will be concluding a 90-day finding regarding the listing decision either at the end of this year or early in next year. I'll say that we have reviewed that petition in terms of the arguments presented as to why it ought to be federally listed, and we stand by the recommendation that we've given you.
What range did that petition utilize, the 6 square miles or the 277?
The current known range. Okay. And there's a little ambiguity in their petition relative to the Scott Barr salamander and its role in this. They think really both of those should be listed. I will comment that in the letter you have before you from the Center for Biological Diversity, it's apparent to me from reading that letter that they haven't read the revised petition that we submitted to you, wherein we address the difference between the significance of the recent identification of Scott Barr salamander as a separate species. So if there's ambiguity in there, it's because they haven't read that in the later petition, I believe. Next issue, status of the available information. Well, I think it's fair to say that the existing information does not answer all potential questions about the species biology or response to disturbance. And the data I presented up there, a scientist would like to have, pose a hypothesis, collect enough data, subject it to statistical analysis so that they can be certain within a 95% certainty that that data reflects the real result. The data for Siskiyou Mountain salamander is not extensive enough to apply that kind of analysis. Still, we think we have enough information to make these decisions. And certainly, we have a lot more information than was available when the species was originally listed as rare. If we knew what we knew now, we would not be proposing it as a rare species or a threatened species or an endangered species. Mr. President, you have your mic on. Were you going to ask me something?
No. Okay. I stand ready to go anytime.
Another outstanding issue, scientific review and disagreement. I'll say first of all that we went through several iterations of the status review. As the status review developed and we began to draw conclusions from the information that we had, it morphed into a draft petition for delisting. We did solicit reviews and recommendations at multiple stages from scientists within and outside of Department of Fish and Game. And while I can say that we received a lot of input, there is and will be disagreement regarding the basis for delisting. not all scientists who have information and expertise with the species will agree with this recommendation. Last issue, relative to monitoring. The data that we have would indicate, I would say, that timber harvesting reduces the suitability of habitat for Siskiyou Mountain Salamander. If you harvest on habitat, it's likely that the population will be smaller for some time afterwards, but they will continue to occupy that habitat. We'll find all life stages there, and over time those populations recover in disturbed habitat. This is not unlike any other species that occupies a piece of ground where you harvest timber on it or conduct some other activity. It changes the habitat conditions. You would expect a biological response where the species composition and numbers would change. And the department believes that if the commission decides ultimately to delist the species, monitoring is warranted to better document effects of timber harvesting and case studies that we've not really had the opportunity to conduct in detail so far because of the take prohibitions under the California Endangered Species Act. In other words, we ought to monitor our decisions to validate whether or not they were good decisions or should be modified later. So our recommendations to the commission are that you find that there's sufficient information detailed in the petition to indicate that delisting may be warranted and accept the petition for further consideration. If you do that, the next steps are that the commission would publish a notice of acceptance and finding that the action may be warranted. The department would solicit additional data and scientific review of the petition and information that comes in over the next before a final decision is made. We would need to prepare a notice of preparation, an initial study, and initiate a CEQA process to prepare an environmental document and get public input there. There would be multiple opportunities for public comment. The department would prepare a final status report for the commission, and then the commission would take a final action. During this time, the species would retain its threatened status. I think I can speak for our director, Ryan Broderick, because I've heard him say this several times. It's the department's view that the Endangered Species Act should work both ways. We should be listing and protecting species where that action is warranted, and in some instances where it's no longer warranted, we ought to be delisting species. And with that, I'll conclude and try to answer any questions you might have.
Any Commissioner Hattori?
I have a few questions. First of all, I wanted to agree with what you just said. I think as a, you know, advocate for Endangered Species Acts, you know, being a person who's worked at the Department of Interior for 9 years and been dealing with this on a federal level and now on a state level, it's a good thing when we delist a species if we can actually come to the conclusion that there's evidence that a species has been recovered or a management plan has worked or a cooperative agreement between, you know, landowners or the federal government has brought something back. It's a good thing for a number of reasons. It shows that we can save species and that we can come up with plans or species is recovers at a level that we didn't understand before. And it also protects the integrity of other species that are on the threatened or endangered list when we take species off that don't need to be there anymore. So if we find that this is the right thing to do, I think it's a good thing that we do it both ways, both list species and delist species. In saying that, I just want to make sure I understand a few things. I guess I'm just asking for your assumptions, unless there's actual data. But I guess I'm going to ask you, do you think this species adapted and relocated and learned to reproduce in all these areas because we had those hypotheses you mentioned and we were just wrong in our hypotheses? Or did some management plan or regulatory, rule that was in effect over the last, 15, 20 years, did that help them? I mean, why do you think they rebounded? They were never threatened to begin with?
They were never threatened to begin with.
Okay.
The species, based upon genetic work, the species has been here for a very long time, perhaps 3 to 5 million years.
Yep.
So they have been through times that were warmer, times that were drier. They have been through catastrophic wildfires. It was incomplete investigation, incomplete data. I don't think, frankly, that through the California Endangered Species Act, the species has recovered. This is one of those species for which, when you look back at the data you relied upon 35 years ago, you realize it wasn't really what you would have liked to have. It was a precautionary action by the commission at the time, but now we know that there's more of them.
So we're talking about the differences you were telling us about. Instead of 8 sites, there are over 200. Instead of 6 square miles, there are over 277 square miles, which would be no indication that it would be threatened today, I mean, if we were to look at it today.
That's right.
Okay, the other question I have is, over the last 30 years, is there any sort of voluntary program or regulatory actions that are in play now that would no longer be in effect if we delisted it that you might think would have a negative impact on the species?
Well, I think the answer is yes, there would be a negative impact on the species. And that is because, as I said, I believe timber harvesting reduces the suitability of the habitat for Siskiyou Mountain salamander. Further, if it's conducted at a time where they're near the surface, these salamanders move up and down within the soil profile, and you can only find them on the surface by turning over the first layer of rock under very narrow range of conditions. If you were driving a tractor to do timber yarding at that particular time, then there's a good chance you're going to crush some salamanders.
Sure.
Direct. So removing the take prohibition under CESA would cause individual salamanders to be killed, and the suitability would probably decline for a period of time. This species exists in what we call a metapopulation structure. That is, they're not in a continuous distribution. They're distributed in disjunct small populations where habitat is suitable, so that you might affect one or two or three occurrences with a timber harvesting plan if it's large. The others are not affected by that.
Sure.
There's not much movement between the populations. But it would not be true to say that there would be no effect on salamanders, because there would.
But as your scientific view, that because of the diversity of the range and the status, those individual takes that would happen coincidentally with timber harvest wouldn't impact the total number of the species.
That's correct.
I mean, to the point of making it threatened.
Yeah. At the population level, the impacts would not be really measurable.
Okay. And I guess the final question I have is, it's just interesting to me that I guess you guys looked at this species. Why? Because you started finding it in places that you didn't think it was going to be. It challenged your scientific knowledge about, we thought this and now we think. I mean, it was interesting to see that we, 30 years ago, like all of us, had hypotheses that were, you know, A, B, C, D, and E, and you proved every one of them wrong. And I'm just wondering, mm-hmm. does
not,
that
not
impact all kind of species? I mean, do we have to go look at everything we've ever done and do a better job, or what does this show, you know?
They weren't all wrong.
Okay.
We knew, for example, that you found them on talus slopes, and in fact, right. It is the best habitat for them. We knew that they were... They existed in forested habitats there. So it's not accurate to say that all of our hypotheses
are wrong. I didn't mean to do that as a negative. I meant it's interesting to me that when we re-looked at it and thought, in that term I hate, outside the box, mm-hmm. we found all kind of new things and saw that they were kind of healthy and doing quite well.
Right. Well, as you know, the issuance criteria for an incidental take permit under CESA are fairly rigorous.
Yeah.
Full mitigation. And as we started looking at questions, the first THP I worked on was principally with a company called Fruit Grower Supply Company. And they brought us data that showed that the animals were there. And we authorized incidental take through a code section that no longer exists, 2090, and included some monitoring as requirements. And information started coming back about finding these animals in habitats that these hypotheses would have predicted that you didn't. But under the current issuance criteria right now, how do you fully mitigate for a species that isn't really threatened in the first place, that lives underground?
You can't, and that's what
you can't make more habitat.
The whole thing, right?
So the difficulty of devising incidental take criteria caused us to try to learn more about the biology of the species. And as we learned more, we actually became less concerned about the population as a whole.
So, and I guess the final question I have, and I'm sorry, but you're pretty comfortable with, as a scientist, if we lift the incidental take ban, even in the worst case scenario where timber companies say, yahoo, there's no longer any restrictions on siskiyou, salamanders, let's go, you know, bulldoze some habitat. And the worst case scenario, we still have enough distribution and status and range and populations that you still think that the animal would not be, needed to be listed as a threatened species.
I think it would be responsible for us to monitor the consequences of our decision. But even if we do so, if we remove these prohibitions, 76% of the range is in either late serial reserves or wilderness areas.
Okay, just checking. Thank you.
Commissioner Gustafson.
Two questions. One, on the letter that we received from the Center for Biological Diversity, there's an excerpt on the quoting the Forest Service study done in 2001. And in that, the Siskiyou Mountain salamander may require, and it's related to the ecological conditions in the late Searle Forest. Mm-hmm. Have you reviewed fully the Fish and Wildlife Service's study, and have they looked at the work that you've done in this?
Yes.
And they are accepting your work, or do you've reviewed their?
I hesitate to speak for them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They haven't told me what they think, so I hesitate to speculate.
Okay.
Their initial.
But you've reviewed their work.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And their initial decision, by the way, on the petition was that it wasn't warranted.
Okay.
Now, also on federal lands, you may know that over the past since the. In the Northwest Forest Plan, there's been survey and manage requirements. And this is a sensitive species in the Klamath. And for a long period of time, the Forest Service was required to conduct surveys and then manage for these species. They're not prevented from taking the animal under the State Act, under federal supremacy. But in a survey and manage, they had to look for them and then manage for them. Well, a couple of years ago, I don't know the exact date, portions of that requirement were lifted, and they weren't no longer required. And it's my understanding right now that there's litigation to reinstitute that. Is that?
Yes.
Right. So, you know, I can't predict whether or not they're going to continue to do that work, but they have been collecting that data in the past. And you can tell me what will happen in court, but because I don't know whether that will be reinstituted.
Have they looked at these sites that you've shown where they're not late Searle Forest and...
A lot of the disturbed sites are on Forest Service ground because they weren't looking as hard as the private landowners were.
Okay. And then on the next steps on the timeline, this again, you said the species remains threatened during this process as we go through the full EIR.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So it remains in the threatened status, and that process takes approximate timeline for the completion of the environmental document?
It would be hard to say that it would be done in less than nearly a year.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Rogers.
Interestingly enough, all my questions were asked by my other fellow commissioners. But as someone who's worked in conservation and biodiversity for a very long period of time myself, I have always believed in the value of the joint partnerships between the various agencies, but also in public and private partnerships. One of the chilling factors, I think, for the public and private partnerships has often been the fact that there are very few delisting petitions, and therefore the people's efforts never seem to get rewarded. I am very, very encouraged by this and like very much this petition. What I like about it is that it's scientific robustness so that it can be defended and it's an appropriate position to take. But I also really like the idea that it shows that there is not simply a one-way street going on here; that there is a two-way street. So, I am very much in favor of doing this. Thank you.
It's just to me, it's just good to see that that the department and scientists and biologists are changing with the times.
Yeah.
30 years ago, we didn't have the technology and the equipment and the stuff. It's kind of like we didn't have DNA 30 years ago, and that's really changed.
We had it.
Changed the world. So,
in some instances,
yeah, we had it. We just didn't know it.
It seemed to be ignored in some of the instances.
And the thing for me is that we're not doing the species any harm by moving forward. and deciding to warrant a delisting petition gives us an opportunity to hear from the people that may not be in favor of it and the public, and I think that that's all good and part of our duty. So,
Mr. President, will you entertain a motion?
Yes, sir.
I move that we accept it's a petition, right?
Yeah, we have to say there's sufficient findings.
Yeah, there is sufficient findings.
Well, before we go there, we probably should see if there's anyone from the public, even though we don't have any speaker cards submitted. If there is anyone in the audience that would like to comment on this item.
But these are the actions that are before you for consideration.
Right. Seeing none, then
I've got a motion. I need a second.
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 Halt.
Oh, this one person wants to speak before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't jump up there right away. I almost jumped in your space. My name is Stuart Farber. I'm the supervising biologist for Timber Products Company, Wildlife and Fisheries, and I've been the principal investigator in two studies for the Siskiyou Mountain Salamander and Scott Barr Salamander in California. And I currently have a study going on with Siskiyou Mountain Salamanders in the state of Oregon, which has the same species, but there's no take prohibition, so we can actively pursue cause and effect type studies that aren't allowed in California. And I just wanted to let it be known that the big item that I think all of you mentioned already today was that we've collected a tremendous amount of information on a species that seems to tolerate an incredibly wide variety of habitats, a lot of disturbed habitats. And it is refreshing to hear the board member, the commission members, and department, when the information is available that warrants the species can tolerate disturbance, natural and human disturbance, that probably in that process, I'm not familiar totally with your process, but it just doesn't need as much protection probably as other species that don't tolerate those disturbances. So I just wanted to let you know that not only from a professional's position, but also just a public citizen, that we need to use science to make our decisions, and it goes both ways, and it's nice to see that. So I just want to say thanks.
Okay.
Can I interrupt for just a moment, please? Would you fill out a speaker card and turn that into us?
Absolutely.
So that we can have appropriate information. Thank you.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Ayes have it, and that'll be the order.
Oh, well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. It was a good presentation.
Thank you, yes.
Our next item is item 4, and it's in two parts. The first part is consideration of certification of the final environmental document, adoption of findings and proposed project or an alternative, and then final adoption of the 2005-2006 commercial herring regulations, section 163. And then the addition of Section 163.1 of Title 14 California Code of Regulations. And I will say that 163.1 only deals with the transfer fee at this time. The Commission at your last meeting in San Luis Obispo authorized staff to publish notice to pick up a public recommendation to look at additional changes or additions, rather, to Section 163.1, which the Commission will be considering at your November meeting in Santa Barbara. And then the second part of this item is the consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 164 of Title 14 California Code of Regulations regarding herring eggs on kelp. The first part of this, this is the time and the place for the Fish and Game hearing on the adoption of the proposed 2005-2006 commercial herring fishery regulations. The Department of Fish and Game has prepared an environmental document related to this fishery and proposed changes. That 45-day public review and comment period commenced on June 30th and ended on August 15th. Today, the Commission is scheduled to review that final environmental document and consider materials and comments that may have been provided on the document and the Department's responses, and then consider certification of that final environmental document, after which we would go into a discussion of the proposed regulatory changes. Does the department want to provide any comments or updates on the final environmental document? Commissioners have a copy of the document, so a motion would
be in order. I'll make a motion that we accept the final environmental document.
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Ayes have it. Now be the order.
At your last meeting in San Luis Obispo, the department provided an update on the proposed changes to Section 163. And I don't know if the department wanted to make any comments at this time or if the commissioners have any questions related to the changes.
The only comment the department has, I think we've reviewed the options, and I can do that again if you prefer. We'll maybe discuss it. The key thing that's a little different is we, in the process of putting together a 2-inch net proposal, we missed the need to change the way we measure the nets. It was designed for the 2 1/16 net, so we made an adjustment so that it works for the 2-inch net. That's the only change we've built into it.
Yeah, we all received a copy of that amendment.
Right. Then there was a proposal by the fishermen to make those measurements on a wet net. Is that going to incur instead of a dry net? Because individuals that have used gill nets before, you know that there is some shrinkage involved when they sit around dry for a while.
Yeah, our procedures that we currently have allow for measurement of wet net. I mean, that they can do that now. And matter of fact, we often encourage them to get them wet because we recognize that they stretch when they're wet. So we're already there, is my understanding. I think, Nancy, I've got that right, right? If I'm wrong, please tell me. Right. 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 But they have that option. So,
well,
any smart herring fisherman will get their net wet.
What does this imply then that if anybody had a net violation where they were found to be out of compliance and it was done dry, that would throw the whole thing into a cocked hat?
I'll let my chief of enforcement answer that.
She who must be obeyed.
Yeah. No, that wouldn't throw that case out. The net still has a requirement for fishing herring. So if it would be on the reel and it would be dry, it would still have to abide by the 2-inch mesh. I believe that most of the herring fishermen will tell you that as soon as they use their net one time, that it stretches. They all have to buy their nets to the specification of 2 inches. And after they get it wet, it generally stretches from there. But we wouldn't want to have a net on the reel during the herring season while they're out actively herring. That would be in violation of the law.
Nancy, I've been following this personally and other commissioners, and I know that the fishermen that fish this fishery have talked to the manufacturers and been assured that the new two-inch nets are going to meet the specifications, and the fishermen are, in fact, buying both size nets. So what I would encourage the department is that I've looked at some of the numbers as well, and in view of the budget problems and stuff we have, that maybe we've all learned through this 3-year process that the fishermen are, in fact, friends of that fishery as well. And I mean, the department spent $300,000 just on enforcement last year for that fishery, and I think we can maybe divvy out some of that enforcement to other areas rather than spending so much time worrying about nets that stretch and shrink
Well, I think with the net size change, there will be some discretion in that from the bigger mesh. But when we found in the net measuring or net certification program was many of the nets were actually very large instead of, you know, at that small range, mm-hmm. just due to fishing. And they also did have problems with the net manufacturers where they were very inconsistent in making their nets. But we'll be strategic in our enforcement deployment. We have to be if we end up with very few game wardens in the future.
I know that the director himself went over and watched the measuring last year and said it was a zoo. The other thing, Sankey, while we're on the subject, is that I know that they have volunteered monies to help do the studies out there, because we also spend like $900,000 on doing the studies on that fishery. And I know from personal experience that getting outside money is a bureaucratic disaster trying to get it to work into the system. But with the budget keep dropping the budget like we are today, we're going to have to figure out a way to take advantage of the opportunities that the outside interests are offering us, because we could probably, with their help, get the same study done for a heck of a lot less more money than what we've been spending in the past on that.
You're absolutely right, Commissioner Kellogg. The good news is that we have agreements with a lot of the fishermen already. One of the more time-consuming, expensive parts is actually having somebody on the water knowing when the fish show up and start spawning, and we have fishermen who've already agreed to help us locate the spawns and tell us about movements of fish in the bay. And it's a wonderful thing they can do because they're out there looking for them, too. Plus, we're also looking at Sea Grant. They have funding, outside funding, that they may be able to help do some of the survey work or research. So we are already aggressively looking for collaborative opportunities to help us deal with a much smaller staff and budget in current year and future years. So we are there. The fishermen are eager to help, and we're going there, and you know we're going to be fishing here in December already, so we're setting this up already.
Any other questions or comments? I would like to make a motion that we
have some.
Oh, we have comments. Public? Okay.
Eddie Genovese, followed by Paul Weakland.
Hello, Mr. President, members of the commission, and the department. I'll be brief. I just appreciate the time that's been spent on this. It's been a lot of time by the commissioners. We've seen commissioners go from one end of it on their opinion to more towards the middle, say, and we appreciate that. The commission can feel perfectly comfortable, or has the right to feel comfortable, if they pass the 2-inch. With the data we have from Tomales Bay, which shows no change in H-class caught, and the department is okay with it now. So I really appreciate all that. I just want to say that although I don't agree, and a lot of the fishermen don't agree with the reduction in quota, we don't think it correlates with the mesh size reduction. Because of the cooperation from all you, we're cooperating on that. But we and Mr. Mastrop said we're going to address that every year. As a whole new thing. I mean, this is going to be brand new to us, and we have our opinion, and it's real strong, and we hope, well, we know we're right now. We hope we're right, and that's about all I have. Do the commissioners have any questions, Ms. Commissioner Rogers? Or
well, I think we beat this thing to death.
Yeah, I do, too. I see a picture of the new commissioner. When'd she start?
Mr. Weakland?
No, sir. I yield my time to any herring fisherman wants to speak.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other speakers?
No, sir.
Okay. I would make a motion that we adopt the the code and implement the 2-inch net with the amendment for that we received from the department today to cover the difference in the measuring.
Okay. Yeah, if we're going to adopt the right recommendations after all these years, yes, I second that motion.
Okay. Okay, I have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Sonke.
I have a quick question.
Late. We voted.
Sonke, don't make us.
Come on, Sonke.
What
did
you
do
wrong, Sonke?
No, I just, it's a matter of clarity.
Yeah.
So did you choose option two on the quota to go
yeah.
with the 2 inch?
Quota
okay,
and
I just
inch.
Wanted to make sure I had
yep.
that straight.
That
right.
was the compromise. Okay.
Could I ask one question?
No, that's what you wanted.
If it takes 15 seconds, yes.
I think you're aware. I don't hear too well. The 2 inches is in now.
Yes.
Because the net manufacturers wanted me to call them
yeah.
before they put in the orders.
Yep.
So I could do that.
Yeah, you just got it.
Thank you. And you have a good day, all of you.
Thank you.
3 years on this.
Drive careful going back.
Go fishing.
Thank you.
And all the rest of the dates and everything have been.
Yep.
Right.
Next item.
Next item is dealing with Section 164, herring eggs on kelp. Basically, depending on the quota that you adopt for Section 163, the gillnet herring fishery, that quota usually is then transferred over to 164. I don't know if there's any questions from the commissioners. If not, a motion would be in order.
No questions. I can make the motion to adopt the proposed changes.
Second.
Okay, got a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Ayes have it. Now be in order.
Thank you. Next item is consideration of possible amendment to commission policy regarding commercial use of native reptiles. The commission may recall at your last commission meeting in review of the policies, the department made some recommendations for changes in your policy on commercial use of native reptiles. Those proposed changes have been provided to you in your analysis and strikeout underline format. They're mainly technical changes to the policy or clarification items. There's no speaker card on this item, so unless you have questions of your staff or the department, a motion would be in order for adoption.
Move to adopt.
Second.
Got a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Ayes have it. Now be in order.
Thank you. We move to consent calendar, items 6 through 14. At the time of preparation of the agenda, your staff knew of no opposition to these proposals. The department has provided a recommendation which calls for adoption and or modified adoption. We do have an individual that would like to speak on three of these items. Items 6, 7, and 9. 6 and 7 are requests to go to notice for a regulatory change. Item 9 is an extension of a aquaculture lease. Mr. Weakland, would you like to come up and provide your comments on those three items, please?
No, sir. My concerns were covered on 6 and 7, number 9. Aquaculture has had a deplorable record in California. The laws are not adequate to control or keep the ethics of aquaculture in check in California. They seem to purge their records of all mistakes and wrongdoing. There is a big concern about the use of steroids, antibiotics, hormones, and some of the techniques that are supposed to be closed systems, and they are not. And we have heard time and time again, this particular lease in Santa Barbara, that how convenient it is to have an offshore facility, just like the oil companies. You know, they have ability to drill 25 miles in a linear direction, but they want to put their offshore oil drilling 3 miles off the coast. That's because when the waste starts to pile up, it looks bad on land. Same thing with these offshore aquaculture facilities. Maintenance and inspection of their underwater debris piles has not been adequate. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. President, I'd also like to remove item number 13S. Just a couple of questions on that item. And then I'd make a motion to approve the remaining consent calendar items.
Okay.
Second. Okay, I got a motion to approve the consent calendar with the exception of item 13. And second, so all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Ayes have it, now be in order.
On 13, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That's okay. On item 13, my questions are more policy-driven. In accepting small parcels of land that are based on mitigations and in considering the department's budget, I'm concerned, are there other ways that we could have the local jurisdictions who are the beneficiaries of this private development accept and protect these lands versus the department? I just see this as they're gaining from the development potential in the adjoining properties. This 80 acres appears to be isolated from any other department holdings, and I'm, again, it's just a policy question for my edification as a new commissioner.
It's a good question, Commissioner, and having been a local official as as you were, we do know that there is a struggle at the local level with not only taking this out of the tax base, but then seeing a piece of property that's not, maintained to the highest level or operated, consistent with sometimes, very good habitat protection orientation. So, but to answer your question, we have had some discussion recently about how we can come up with operating funds for this. We'll continue to work on that, and we just had, as a matter of fact, a conversation with Assemblyman Tom Harmon, and he's very interested in this subject, and we'll be working on that with them, and I'll try to come back with you with a report on anything new that develops for that.
Yeah, my concern is, I mean, the $6,400 for the long-term endowment of an 80-acre parcel, and I'm not, I just can't imagine that comes close to the department's long-term commitment.
Probably doesn't even cover trash pickup.
Right.
Just as another perspective, the department and this whole process of these mitigations, we're not the only recipients. Sometimes we've passed these on to third-party NGOs when we actually have a fair number of these mitigation projects being managed by these third-party entities and even counties. So that's already being done. I'm not always familiar why we end up with some of them, but I think there's room to really have a broader scale discussion and really looking for answers that work. We have serious concerns about being able to manage these. Plus, even the third-party deals are not guarantees. We've had one or two go bankrupt on us, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden we have a mitigation agreement that's not valid anymore, really. So this has kind of been a problem that's been growing, and there is not a good answer yet. And I think it would be a very good thing to have discussion and maybe a focused look at, is there a better way of doing this?
Well, I think from local jurisdictions' perspective, as Mr. Stein mentioned, we have quite a few of these acquisitions in the Tahoe Basin. Quite often, these are the most neglected parcels of land that occur, and many times the local communities would prefer a different level of maintenance and are willing to fund it. The neighbors, adjoining property owners, want to see them maintained to a higher degree than they are, and that's not by the Fish and Game, that's other agencies I'm speaking of. So I'd certainly like to look into this more, especially considering the budget shortfalls of the department. I'll move approval of item number 13 unless there's any other questions.
Thank you for the questions.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment, too. I thank Commissioner Gustafson for providing that personal experience, which will allow us to focus on this in a better way. That's a good remark. Thank you.
This would have just slipped through otherwise. Thank you. Okay,
so I made a motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Ayes have it, now be in order. We're going to take a 5-minute going to the restroom break.
Okay. And then we have to go. Yeah, we have to go. Yeah.
I knew I didn't know. Thank you.
anything comment on any of this?
Well, I made a comment earlier on during the public comment period. Yeah. Oh, I had to stand up and talk about the issue that came out of Alaska County Fish and Game Commission regarding the BLM tags and trying to keep it at 10% of the take the way it's been, not to increase it. We actually had a resolution come out of the county commission, and the county supervisors had a resolution also, and we passed it on to the board. And then I talked a little bit about the juniper and sagebrush step restoration project for Forest Service and BLM starting up. Sounds like to me on this 13, that's what always gets me. See, they must have put in a development, and they have made them put 80 acres aside for mitigation. But they want the Fish and Game to manage it. People ought to manage it. It's where people live in the development. They ought to have to pay a little extra tax so that they have, so that their money manages that mitigation. The Fish and Game shouldn't take it.
Oh, I agree. That's one of the things that's almost breaking the county.
Well, there is. It's a different project.
Oh, but it's a different project. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Well, good. Just wanted to say hi.
Yeah. Yeah, good. So you're out of Sacramento, though?
Yes.
Well, I guess your office has moved in to Rockland, yeah, a few years ago.
And you know what?
2 years ago? Yeah, I haven't been to the Rockland office. I was at the other office one there. Once.
Never got anything less than 4 points
in an endowment.
Let me see. What is it? Former cashier. Looks like this one's already been processed.
You're delaying mine.
You guys ready?
Oh, it has that je ne sais quoi.
We got the plane on its way, so we gotta get going. Okay, we're gonna call the meeting back to order and move on to the next item on our agenda.
Before we move there, Mr. President and Commissioners. There's two items that came to the Commission's attention after your agenda was published. So pursuant to Government Code Section 11125.3, the Commission may add an item that came to your attention after your agenda was published on a two-thirds vote. And the two items, just so you know, is similar to the one we just discussed before break. It's to give the department authorization to accept a real estate project from the Wildlands Incorporated for Jenny Farms Conservation Bank. It basically is a transfer of approximately 434 acres of habitat management land located in Solano County. And the other one is to provide authority to the department to issue a letter permit to a security guard for Sierra Pacific Industries to allow their forest patrolmen to carry a firearm inside the Tuolumne State Game Refuge for his protection. So if you would like to consider these, we would need a two-thirds vote.
For the consent calendar?
Yeah, just...
Yeah.
I'll make a motion to add those to the to the agenda today.
Okay. And a second?
Do you have a question? I mean, it looks like he has a question.
Question?
Well, I'll second, but I'd love to ask a question about the latter motion.
Yeah, me too. That's what I was just wondering how that works.
I think at this point you're just voting to have it on the agenda,
got
and
it,
then
got
we'll
it,
take them individually.
Because I was going to say I didn't want to interfere with what
I understand,
our wardens
but
do.
But did you have anything about that? I mean, well,
security guard.
We'll wait a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right.
So we're putting it on the agenda to consider later. Let's do it. Okay.
Exactly.
Sorry.
So it's seconded.
Okay.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Ayes have it. Now be to order.
Okay. Thank you. And the first one, I passed out the department's memo to you dated September 7th regarding the Jenny Farms Conservation Bank and the...
Bob.
Yes.
I want to find out from legal counsel if we did that right. You mentioned to me that we had to have a vote of two-thirds of the members just to entertain voting
yes.
on that.
Right, which we just
yes,
did.
Yes, Mr. President. And I actually calculated that out, and that means that we had to have 3 1/3 members of the commission agree to that motion so that you could then...
But we didn't have to vote on even considering it before
yes,
we had a motion?
No.
That's what I thought you meant.
No. Your motion that you just agreed to, as I understand it, was to go ahead now
right.
and accept that
right.
as additional
to
items to
the agenda.
So, yes,
yeah.
you have accomplished what the statute requires.
Okay. I misunderstood you earlier. I thought we had to have a vote of our commission to even entertain discussing having a motion.
No, sir.
Okay. All right.
No, sir.
By the way, I'm sorry that this didn't come up at the last meeting because my voice from the sky presence could have been the 1/3 that we needed. Yeah. Sorry about that.
And I don't know if the department wants to make any comments on this Jenny Farms Conservation Bank. We do have an individual that's drove all the way from Wildlands Incorporated, Greg DeYoung, to comment if you would like to hear from him.
Sure, if you drove that far.
No.
We don't care how far you drove. Speak anyway.
It was a beautiful drive. But I very much appreciate your willingness to add our item onto the agenda. And one thing that I hope to convey, I'll be brief, but that the project that you have before you is very much in contrast to the 80-acre mitigation easement that you accepted previously, in that this project is quite a bit larger, and it's all been thought out and planned in collaboration with your department, with the Department of Fish and Game. And so this is what's known as a conservation bank. We're a private entity. We own the property, and again, we're working under the Conservation Bank guidance that the state of California has in collaboration with you folks, and we feel very good about this project. The target species are Swainson's hawk and burrowing owl, and again, it's 407 acres of easement in Solano County.
And you maintain it, and you take care
Correct.
Of it, and you do all those things, and we just
Yes.
leave it as a wasteland, quote-unquote, the way Ms. Custison was concerned about.
Yeah.
No, but you said properties were left.
It will be cared for.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you. Thanks for driving all that way.
Can we make a motion to...
Is that it? On
yeah. No motion would be okay. in order.
To accept the,
to accept
the project?
To provide authorization
yeah.
to the department to...
Have a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Ayes have it. Now be in order.
Take care of those hawks.
And the next one is the providing authorization to the department to issue a letter permit to Sierra Pacific Industries to allow their security personnel to go through the game refuge with a firearm. Right now, the game refuge is there's no firearms allowed, and Sierra Pacific lands are adjacent to this game refuge that was established by the legislature. The commission has the authority to allow transport of firearms through the area. As an example, there's certain game refuges where pine cones are harvested via a .22, and the commission authorizes that action to collect seeds from trees. But this is mainly Sierra Pacific is concerned about this individual's safety.
Questions, Mr. President?
Hmm?
Question.
Okay.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My question regards the firearms qualifications of this particular individual, which was not specified in their letter to us. Okay. I mean, I would be comfortable with someone who was genuinely qualified as a peace officer to carry a firearm in that area. I'm not so sure I would be otherwise.
Well, I would have to question. I would assume that if he's carrying a firearm on their property, that he's got a weapons permit. Wouldn't you, Nancy?
Yeah,
and if he has a weapons permit, then yeah. one of the requirements to carry a weapons permit is that you have to requalify every 2 years. So if that's the case, it shouldn't be a problem.
It is their security guard
yeah.
that is wanting this permit. And
so if he's got a permit to carry on their property, it
do we need
be
to specify, Nancy, in our approval of this that those qualifications be maintained, or is an assumption adequate?
We'd actually like the commission to direct the department to write the letter to SPI to make some of these kind of recommendations to them, make it specific to their security officer, and make sure that they don't do any hunting within the refuge.
I'm good with that.
And one more question. If this is Sierra Pacific's private security guard, why is he patrolling our Tuolumne State Game Refuge?
He isn't. He's going through the refuge to access other properties.
And so while he's there, he has the gun on him, and that's illegal at that moment.
That's correct.
Got it. But we still want to have the guidelines. I got it. Okay, thank you.
Will you accept a motion, Mr. President?
Sankey has a question.
Sankey has a question.
Just a quick point of clarification. The existing game refuges are in name only. In other words, we don't own the land or the commission in most cases. It includes private property, including
right.
Timberlands. It is simply a legal designation that does not allow hunting or fishing within them. This is an old problem because we have landowners that live in these areas that can't use these weapons either. So it's not that we own it or control it in any way. All we simply do through legislation is these are actually the ones left in code. These prevent hunting and fishing inside of them.
Yeah. Well, let's have enforcement issues met.
So if this motion includes what you just requested, Nancy,
well,
the department would be okay?
So I would propose then that I move then that we accept their letter requesting this based upon Nancy Foley writing them, or one of your people writing them a letter setting out the criteria for the carry permit.
Yeah. Second.
I got a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Ayes have it. Now be the order.
Thank you, commissioners and the department. Appreciate it. Our next item is item 15. It's receipt of the department legislative report and possible consideration of commission position on legislation. And Mr. Greg Herner, deputy director over legislation, is here to make the department's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners. Before you, you have a legislative report. I must apologize. I noticed a couple of errors in here. I didn't get to proofread this before I brought the packets up today. And if you would entertain me in this is a draft and there's a lot of bills pending on the governor's desk, we will provide you an accurate report to reflect those late amendments that came within the last week of session, which is what happened here. There's a couple of amendments in a couple of these bills that happened very late in session that didn't get picked up appropriately in this report. So when the governor takes final action on these bills as well by your next meeting, we will have a complete report on all of those bills. And just run through, there's a lot of two-year bills or bills that were held within the legislature this year, and I don't want to belabor the meeting with those bills, but on page one you have AB 7 regarding hatchery funding and wild and heritage trout program funding by Assemblymember Cogdill. I believe we'll have a little bit of a discussion about that when we come back. AB 193 on page 2 is Assemblymember Mays regarding the Mount Whitney fish hatchery. There's been some great public-private partnerships that we've been working on in our hatchery system, some nonprofits that have been formed at the local level to make improvements to our hatcheries, help improve efficiency. And this is going to allow one of those to occur. There's a very historic building on the Mount Whitney site, and it's very valuable to the public there for tourism and also for holding weddings or other special events. This bill is going to allow us to really establish a good formal partnership with the local community in this area. It's a model that we wanted to extend to some of our other hatcheries, but there was some concern within the legislature about extending it this ability to all hatcheries at this time, so it was just kept to the Mount Whitney hatchery. But we hope to continue to work on these public-private partnerships.
Well, Greg, as you may know, the commission was exposed to a significant group of people in Bishop who were really very aggressively interested in supporting the hatchery.
Yes, absolutely. Page 3, Assemblymember Clay's AB 672. This is a good bill. We've been doing on a case-by-case basis extending recreational opportunities to certain lakes that are used for water supply. Assemblymember Clay has kind of said, let's forget that. Let's do it wholesale. There's protections in here for water, drinking water quality protections and stuff, but it still will allow us, we hope, to extend some additional recreational opportunities, particularly in urban areas. So we're looking forward to that bill hopefully being signed and allowing us to implement it. On page 4, pending on the governor's desk, is AB 749 by Leno. Commission's very familiar with that, and we appreciate your quick action at the last meeting regarding that bill, and we're looking to find solutions here where we can appropriately move that fishery to the commission's oversight, and so we'll continue to work on that pending the outcome of this bill.
Yeah, there's confusion.
On page 5 is AB 820 by Assemblymember Strickland dealing with wild animals. These are not all wild animals, just exotics. The department worked pretty extensively with the author to try and reform some of the reporting requirements in code and make mandatory reporting for any escaped exotic animals, and So we'll likely be looking at doing some implementation in that bill and reforming that program a little bit. Page 6, AB 1200, Laird. This is very similar to, this is basically a risk assessment of the Delta levies program. It's already going on under CalFed. There's a slight, well, it's very similar criteria to what we're already doing under CalFed. This just kind of codifies it. So, page 7, Wolk. AB 1328, Wild and Scenic Rivers for Cache Creek. That one is pending. AB 1431, Saldana, the fishing trawl nets, that's the cleanup bill that from the trawl bill from last year. So that's really pretty, well, that one was actually already signed. So pretty non-controversial, and that was just fulfilling the author's commitments from the T.D. Alpert's commitments. Laird Tamarisk Plant Control, AB 1466, sets up a program for tamarisk removal and stuff along the Colorado River to increase water supplies. As you probably know, the department's actively engaged in a lot of areas down in that corner of the world. Chief Deputy Stein is working with the salt and sea issues, and these are all kind of interrelated with the multi-species conservation program down in that area and the QSA, Quantification Settlement Agreement on the Colorado River. So there's some protections to make sure that this new program doesn't impact any of those existing programs and allows us to make sure that we're restoring adequate habitat and not just removing tamarisk without providing other types of habitat for some of the species that are in potential jeopardy. Well, I shouldn't say jeopardy, but species of concern or listed species in the area. And the last few bills here on page 11, there's a bill by Senator Kehoe regarding a conservation easement registry. A lot of this work is already being done at the local level regarding posting conservation easements. So California State Association of Counties have a good program that they're monitoring all of their counties' compliance with the previous bill. And as you know, the Wildlife Conservation Board provides an annual report regarding all of the easements that they acquire during the year. So there's pretty full disclosure right now, but this would require some additional posting requirements online. SB 771 Sumidian, ocean-going ships. This takes part of a task force report regarding discharges that for ocean-going ships that aren't currently covered under law and would extend some reporting requirements. There's no real enforcement behind this, and really our oil spill prevention and response unit is really the only one out there doing enforcement operations on any type of ships. So it's potentially, it's some mandatory reporting requirements, but without any true inspection. So depending on what happens with that, we may be looking at that issue again in the coming year.
I'd understood that the impetus behind this bill was really from fish and game wardens who wanted to be stationed on cruise ships.
Wouldn't we all? Had I known
wrong, Nancy. I'm sorry.
FEMA can do that, though. They can put you on and give, never mind.
Yes, yes. That would be good. And then, unfortunately, this bill failed to capture our ability to do that. So that's why we might, without explicitly stating that was the reason. I'm sorry, Commissioner, but yes, we would like to make sure that our wardens can get out there and check out the food bar. Discharges right from the ship. SB 1028 Bowen was the computer-assisted remote hunting. Of course, you all know, you already took action on that covered that issue well. So this would basically codify a portion of your action because yours was actually more extensive. And SB 1086 by Senator Migdon on page 13, this extends the Resources Trust Fund till July 1st, 2011, those are the Tideland funds that a lot of those funds go to resource type programs, although a large chunk still does go to the, goes to the general fund. This bill simply extends that, the resources trust fund, since if it sunsetted, all the funds would instead accrue to the general fund. So this would keep that program going, and then annually the legislature usually looks at what resource issues are pending and makes some decisions and makes some amendments to the resources trust fund to allocate that funding. So this would continue that. So those bills are all pending. And then AB 7, I want to go back to that one. That bill is in, Commissioner Rogers, as you said at your hearing, you had a lot of people inquiring about hatcheries and funding for hatcheries, and this is Assemblymember Cogdill's effort to try and address those concerns. The department never released a formal position on the bill during the session because we were trying to work extensively with the author and had many discussions. Chief Deputy Stein, myself, Deputy Director Mastrip, and other members of the department had several meetings with the assembly member during the year. We were not able to work out the type of resolution that we had hoped for in the bill. But this bill would create a new dedicated account within the Fish and Game Preservation Fund, and it would take one-third of all license sales and put them in that fund. It would require specific mandates on the amount of trout that have to be produced. It would require mandates on the number of native trout that could be produced, which would finalize at a 25% requirement, and it would have to be at least five species of native trout, and one of those could not be coastal rainbow, which of course represents the greatest, has the most extensive native habitat area, potentially up to 90% of native trout habitat is coastal rainbow. And then it would provide $2 million annually to the Native and Wild and Heritage Trout Program. And it authorizes positions to be hired through the legislation rather than going through the budget process. In our discussions with Assemblymember Cogdill, we raised some concerns because in our budget committees this year we were the number of dedicated accounts that the department has, reduces our flexibility and our ability to respond to changing conditions and creates really a very difficult administrative process to try and track and appropriately account for all of those funds, which, there is an audit that Assemblymember Cogdill requested the previous year that came out and basically said that, this is challenging for the department to do this. There were some members that suggested that we should eliminate some of our dedicated accounts to allow more flexibility, which would help us, which they believe would help, us to implement policy guidance from whether it's the commission or from internally from the director. There are some concerns about the number of trout that this bill would mandate because we've only been able to produce that number of trout once previously, and that was when the commission changed their definition of catchable size trout from 4 to the pound to 2 to the pound, and we held a bunch of fish over in order to meet that new requirement that gave us a substantial amount of fish in that following year because we had to hold them over and then release them at one time. But it's substantially above the 4.6 million pounds that we have averaged since about 1982. So if there's any questions.
I'd like to make a motion that the commission draft a letter in opposition to AB 7.
I'll second that motion.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Ayes have it, and that'll be the order.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Good job, man.
Our next item is receipt of department informational items. The first one is an update on the department's budget situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll speak to this one for just a few moments, kind of give you a little bit of an update on where we are in our budget situation. I'll refresh your memory that last month I reported that the Secretary of Resources has really directed us, along with Director Broderick, to address our budget deficit over the next 3 years. Department of Finance has asked us to come up with a plan on how we're going to be repaying the almost $15 million in Fish and Game Preservation Fund deficit, and we do have a long-range plan to do that. It will take approximately 3 years to do, and in so doing, Mr. Christman, the Secretary of Resources, has asked us to prioritize our activities based on revenue to help us do that, so we are working through that right now. We do have the three-year plan in place to pay back the Fish and Game Preservation Fund. In so doing, we have instituted a hiring moratorium that is currently in place. We've also been taking a look at reducing positions, open positions, I might add, through the reduction in the environmental license plate fund. There's going to be approximately 39 positions, I believe, that will be eliminated through that process. As I've talked to Deputy Director Renwick, we may go ahead and retain about seven of those positions and actually put them into our budget shop to help us continue to keep track of future budget analysis and make our streamlining of this a little bit more effective. We are, again, redirecting staff activities to dedicated accounts where activities match that revenue source. So if we've got staff out in the field already doing an activity that comes from a dedicated account, we're going to redirect those activities, as we'd said last month. We are producing a negative BCP to account for these changes, and that will be sent over to finance. And throughout next week, we'll be meeting with the regional managers and the rest of the deputies and the director to complete our reorganization of department activities that will ostensibly streamline the organization going forward. We do need your help, though. We've talked about that a little bit in the past, but I think in this upcoming budget cycle, if we can depend on, and I'm sure we will, I shouldn't say if, your support in the budget process to help us advocate for the department. Augmentations possibly from the general fund would certainly be of great benefit. We do know this, as Deputy Director Herner has just told you, that if AB7 does succeed in being signed by the governor, it's probably going to put a tremendous strain not only on the Marine Division but also our Warden Corps. I would suggest that we might want to advocate through the commission that augmentations from the general fund for the Wardens and the Marine Division certainly would be very supported by the department. So that's kind of a brief snapshot on where we're going with the budget. It's not a pretty sight. We're doing the best we can, and with the director's leadership and Secretary of Resources, Mr. Crispin, helping us, we believe that we'll get through that. But we do need your help.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
You
go. I'd like to also commend the chief deputy and also the director requesting assistance from the commission. Since I've been here for 20 years, this director is only the second director that's asked for the commission's assistance on budget issues. So it's good.
We look forward to that.
We have two individuals who like to
probably shows you how desperate you are, but that is okay.
Tom Raftigan, followed by Delbert Craig.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the Commission. Tom Raftigan, United Anglers of Southern California, and represent over 40,000 affiliated fishermen throughout the state. And we're deeply concerned about the budget. I think we're going to have some things coming up in the Tauscher Committee about some of the ways that part of this was addressed. And I just wanted to make some comments here. First of all, received a letter from Executive Director Traynor saying that you consider the Blue Ribbon Task Force to review the department budget. Where we're going with all this stuff, whether it's a Blue Ribbon Task Force or whether it's through the Tauscher Committee with a budget committee, the budget is extremely important to your constituents, to the people that are out there that hunt and fish and pay a large portion of the DFG funding. The most important thing is we recognize that there are critical shortages of funding within the Department of Fish and Game, critical shortages. We are more than happy to go to bat to try and help alleviate those shortages, but what is just essential is we have to know where this funding is going. We've got a review right now of some of the areas that cuts are coming up. We need to see where our money is coming in and where the money is going out, and we think it's fair that once that's out on the table, we're going to be your strongest advocates down the line for trying to get additional funding. All right, we've got funding that comes in that's dedicated in certain fish and game accounts, and that we want to make sure that that's earmarked there. Okay, I have never seen any of the fishermen that are not in favor of some degree of flexibility within the Department of Fish and Game. We recognize that you are handling an array of unfunded mandates, and we can help track down dollars and cents to go towards those unfunded mandates. But the thing is, this entire process really needs to get out in the open, whether it's through a Blue Ribbon Commission, a Blue Ribbon Task Force that looks at the budget, or as I would hope comes up in the recommendations from the Tauscher Committee. We don't see them. We help make some of the recommendations. But as those recommendations come up, we had a Budget 101, which essentially would be a two-day presentation by the Department of Fish and Game that's laid out the budget, and then come back afterwards where we can view the figures, come back afterwards and make comments on them a third time. These are the things that make sense. And again, it's we're trying to get this stuff out in the open, and I will absolutely, unequivocally, and speaking for not just our 40,000 members, but for the 2 million people that have recreational fishing licenses, we just want to know where that money is, where it's going, and we will stand up and help you get additional funds for the areas that you need it. But we just want to see this thing. If there's one thing I can stress is bring the process out into the open, and you will have literally millions of advocates behind you. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Craig?
Mainly, I just wanted to thank the commission for coming up here this close to our Modoc County. But we do have some budget issues that we're very concerned about. We was very concerned about the hatchery deal. And you might be interested in knowing that Modoc Fish and Game Commission, we've almost taken over the planning of all the Warner Mountains, the high mountain lakes. We have a pack-in plan, and last year we planted 8,000 fish. We went and got them ourselves. We pack them in ourselves, and all we ask is a hatchery furnace of fish. I wasn't able to make it here to the comment session earlier this morning, so we had a meeting yesterday, and we thought we better send somebody to this close to home while we got to keep informed. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Craig. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Let's see. The next item is B, update on the
if
department.
If I may, Mr. Traynor,
yes, sir.
I think that the department being interested in the commission's comments and Tom Raftikin's comments about what all can be done, it's all interconnected. The whole issue of being able to go out to the various stakeholders here and ramp up support, but to be able to present to them why they can do that, which is the transparency of the budget, I think it's really imperative. I really think this is an opportunity to maybe get a paradigm change here. I do.
Well, we were going to address this a little bit later under commission informational items, but if Zonke wanted to, looks like he was ready to comment too. We can make those comments now.
Yeah, I mean, as I think I've spoken for the commission before, it is our intense desire to have our budget be completely transparent. We have nothing to hide. What we've been working on is a way to turn a lot of budgetees, which short of a few CPAs I hear, is very dry and difficult to follow. We, at the Altaltra subcommittee, we agreed to provide the subcommittee with a presentation, basically an explanation on some fundamentals, like how the state does budgeting. A lot of folks don't even understand that process because we typically get the complaint, well, why did you decide to spend the money that way? They don't even know that we serve the Budget Act.
Is this the Budget 101 to which Mr. Rafferty referred?
Yes, we have agreed to come in and, one, explain how the state does its budgeting and makes decisions so they have a clue of who's actually in charge of what, and then go through where our revenues are coming from and then where we're currently spending them. We can do that.
That's really excellent. Yeah. Okay.
And that's a result, Tom, of other interest groups making the same request with the department.
Yeah, you're not alone.
Because that's the comment I was going to make. If you think about other agencies, health, education, all the constituency groups are very well organized during the budget process. I mean, when you think of the Department of Health or something, you have every disease group in the state, you know, breast cancer survivors, cancer, lung association, AIDS organizations, fighting tooth and nail to either hold on or get a bigger piece of the pie. And same thing with the education people. You have, you know, PTA, teachers unions, blah, blah, blah. We are late in the process, and we need to make sure that the 2 million licensees, the 700,000 Sierra Club members in California, we're all working together to do our budget some good. And I think this is a exciting and important opportunity.
Yeah, I agree.
When that meeting occurs, could it be posted as a commission meeting so other commissioners could attend?
Yeah.
Or could we have the same presentation in the other subcommittees? I would hate to have the department duplicated. I'd rather be able to attend and have a quorum at potential.
The Marine Subcommittee could get the same presentation you give the Altaltra Committee.
Yep.
Yeah.
You have to do one for me myself because I'm not in either committee.
I mean, our goal is to kind of have a packaged presentation to explain it as best as it's possible, the fundamentals, and then the bulk of it will be Q&A because there's a lot of misperceptions. We'd like a chance people to ask questions and explain the various things. The issue is so complex, there's really no way to, you know, you'd have to go to college, essentially, to get through this thing. So we're going to package it in what we hope is get you, you know, the 101A, 101B will be down the road, get you there so you have a fundamental understanding of all the players involved, then have a fundamental understanding of what we do, where our money comes from and goes, and then really allow people to really get down and ask questions that that perceptions they may have and either confirm or correct those perceptions.
And in a nonpartisan and but I'm saying we need to also point out where we can make the political difference, where the impact points are, the timing for that and all that, because this all starts in January pretty fast and furiously.
And that's my concern is I hate to see the department have to duplicate this and then have some commissioners, and I would especially appreciate this briefing one way or the other, and I hate to take your time to do it individually. So if we can either post that meeting as potential commission meeting or if we want to take it to the full commission so that we're all briefed.
Okay. As time is of the essence here, that 101A to which you referred needs to be a really, you know, the kimono is open, okay, 101A, because in order to energize the other interest groups, they have to, after 101A, because there's not much time between now and the cycle starts when the gun goes off. So in order to get their energy going, and because some of these associations, if you will, between various interest groups are going to be for the first time.
Yep.
Right.
So there's going to be a little, you know, touchy-feely thing that's going to have to go on there to begin with. So you guys are going to have to be really ready to rock out of the box here.
I mean, you're absolutely right. One of things that has confounded, for example, AB7, I mean, we're being called liars about our concerns about the impacts. And the fundamental truth is they don't understand our budget and our situation. So that's kind of partly our fault. Folks don't understand our budget, and we need to enhance that so we don't have I mean, our fishermen are actually split on this. We have some fishermen who really like what's going on, and then others going, man, I don't like if it's going to hurt other important fisheries functions. But the reality is very few folks understand our budget.
Yeah.
Greg.
Yeah, well, I've been here 10-plus months, plus I did a whole bunch of budgeting for different agencies while I was in the legislature and other jobs, and I still don't understand it. So the fish and game budget is extremely complicated. That's not why I stood up here, but, it's an effort to do. It's an effort to get me up to speed on it that's dealt with budgeting in the past, and it's not a function of anybody's ability. It's just it's a flat out mess in a lot of areas. And that I'll say that, but I'll also say that our team internally is doing an outstanding job, in my opinion, from budget people I've worked with in the past, and doing an outstanding job of trying to get things under control and stabilized right now in the face of all the issues that we're being confronted with. So it is a mess, but we're working on it, and very diligently, and it takes up a lot of time and priorities for every one of the deputy directors in the department, and particularly Chief Deputy Paul Stein, who's responsible in leading this effort. The reason I first got up here is because I think Commissioner Gustafson had a very good idea, in that I would love for the commissioners to be able to attend when we present to the stakeholders, mainly because, the rest of the commissioners, you made some great comments about our stakeholders and stuff. You guys are accountable to the same stakeholders that we are. Yeah. You have an obligation to those stakeholders just as we do. And I think it would be an excellent opportunity for you to hear from those stakeholders as we're presenting the information, so that it's not a filtered process. I mean, we're right. More than happy to make this presentation as the Chief Deputy indicated, as many times as you want. But we are at a critical time, and for you to have unfiltered information from those stakeholders, I think, is going to be extremely valuable to you and how you help us get through this.
Well, if you do this right, and if the stakeholders do this right, we will all actually be an example of our good governor in his memorable line that he delivered in Conan the Barbarian, which was, "That which does not kill you makes you stronger." Now, I didn't say it quite the way he did, but
he said,
but
that,
we could,
he
I don't
said
mean
that
to be,
which makes you stronger. Makes you
I don't mean to be, too obvious about this, but if we do this right, we could end up with something that had a lot of support with varied interest groups who don't normally support one another, and it could actually be quite a good thing, because it is very clear that across the board, the resources of the state of California, which is what the state of California is to a vast majority of the people who live in this state, are being underserved dramatically by this legislature and this budget.
And we all know how it works in Sacramento. You either have to, cause pain or cause power. And, our constituencies of all the varietals out there haven't been activated to work on the budget. And the other thing I want to say is, some of us have to understand it better than others, but coming from the activist community, you don't really have to understand the budget and all of its, machinations, but you do have to understand what you want, how to get it, and apply the political pressure. And, there are certain assembly members and state senators, if all of a sudden they hear from 1,000 anglers in their district, they're going to take notice on this issue, and that's obviously the way that we make this stuff happen. Yeah.
Paul?
Yeah, Mr. President, just one final comment. One of the things that I've noticed in the short time that I've been here is that the Fish and Game Department is not really good at being its own advocate, and I'm really appreciative of hearing, the commission to respond and saying that they want to help us.
Mm-hmm. At the risk of being a comedian, that is one of the most Never mind.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Time to turn tragedy into comedy.
No one would appreciate your help more than I, as Deputy Director Herner said. I have to face Undersecretary Karen Scarborough weekly on this subject. So any help that I can get is certainly appreciated. But so that we can move forward on this, I would just ask Sankey to make sure that we have an invitation to the commissioners at the next Tauscher meeting, and I'll talk to our budget director, Renee Renwick, to make sure that you have the comprehensive first step in Budget 1A, we're calling it, so that we can move forward on this in a timely manner.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, based on the commission's discussions, we may want to expand it beyond the Tauscher committee, and I'll work with Chief Deputy Stein and Deputy Director Mastrip to figure out what's the best approach to take and do it as quickly as we can, because actually the budget process has already started. So thank you. Okay. Next item is update on the department's regulations for coho salmon incidental take by timber harvesting. Mr. Stouffer will be making the department's update.
Mr. President, members of the Commission, Mark Stouffer, Environmental Program Manager from Northern California, North Coast Region. This is a very, this is intended to not give you really detailed information, but I'm prepared to answer any detailed questions you may have. Just to take you back a little bit, coho salmon were listed in California under the California Endangered Species Act as endangered in the southern part of their range and threatened in the northern part of their range. That was effective on March 31st of this year. The Fish and Game Commission directed the department, under authority of Fish and Game Code Section 2112, to develop regulations for incidental take occurring by timber operations. This is the first time that we've ever done this. We've developed several drafts. They have evolved through conversations with our stakeholders, including both members of the timber industry as well as members of the recovery coho salmon recovery team and environmental groups, anybody that's interested in talking with us about this. And so we have I did not bring the current version because it's still a work in progress. It's marked up. The purpose of these regulations, as they have evolved, is that one of the important purposes is that they provide consistent guidance to department staff on how to implement the California Endangered Species Act for timber operations, so that a landowner in northern Mendocino County gets treated under the same circumstances as a landowner in southern Humboldt County, regardless of which fish and game staff or program they may be working with. It also serves the purpose of providing the public with information about how they're going to how they can expect to plan their activities in accordance with the act. And an ancillary element of the guidelines, the regulations that we're developing, is similar guidance to the department on application of the California Environmental Quality Act. You probably know that once a species is listed under the California Endangered Species Act, it receives additional attention and protections through the California Environmental Quality Act as well. Certain findings need to be made relative to those species. I have attached some flow charts, which are intended to kind of lay out the thought process. When there is a timber harvest plan that has least potential consequences for coho salmon, we have to evaluate three different things, really. One, is it going to lead to incidental take of coho salmon? If the answer to that is that it likely will, we also have to evaluate the effects relative to jeopardizing the continued existence of the species. And these go towards the issuance criteria under CESA. So under CESA, there's really two questions. Is it going to take fish? And if it is it going to rise to the level of jeopardy? And then we also have to evaluate the effects under the CEQA guidelines. So a full analysis of a timber harvest plan would include those steps. We have in developing this process, we've developed some methods of application that I think are rather unique compared to what we've done with other species. Where the department does determine that take is likely to occur, the draft regulations offer several different alternative ways to deal with CISA. The first is that they can consult with the department, and we can work with them to modify their project so that we could find that, in fact, take is not likely to occur, and they don't need to go any further down this road. We do this informally with many species now, but this establishes some specific procedures for accomplishing that. Secondly, we have incorporated a standard set of mitigation measures and complete a streamlined incidental take authorization through self-certification. And what we've done here is develop some additional very focused measures where coho focus not only in terms of how they would be applied in the timber plan, but also exactly what part of the range they'd be applied in, wherein a landowner could incorporate these measures on their own volition in a timber harvesting plan, provide a certification to the department that all these measures have been included, and they would be programmatically receive incidental take authorization should it occur. And these areas, frankly, are focused on building upon the existing forest practice rules and focusing on some areas that the department believes need some additional protection measures for coho salmon. These would be smaller water courses and roads in particular. The third alternative is to either take a sample of these, select from among these additional measures for those that are appropriate for the specifics of the individual THP and apply for a regular incidental take permit and go through a longer process. The self-certification could, in fact, be accomplished within 10 days. The landowner would know within 10 days whether they had incidental take authorization. The traditional incidental take permit process often takes years, several years. And so this is one way for a landowner to know what they need to do to get a take authorization and move forward very quickly. That's a self-certification alternative.
They always want certainty, and I understand that, but you're saying they can do this within 10 days?
In other words, if they submit their timber harvesting plan,
yeah,
and they also submit a certification to us that, in fact, all these measures are there,
right,
we have the plan, we can review it and compare it ourselves. But what they would do is send that to the appropriate regional manager, and we would have we would commit to signing that certification and getting it back to them within that short period of time.
That's a good incentive.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We hope it is. And then finally, forest landowners, the larger ones in particular, have proposed what they refer to kind of a fork in the road regulatory approach. Rather than an individual incidental take permit for a timber harvesting plan that may take a long time, some of them would like to look at a watershed scale, develop a watershed analysis, identify the specific limiting factors in that watershed, and then prepare timber harvesting plans in that location that address those limiting factors. And we're certainly open to that idea, but it isn't going to be as simple because it's going to require our individual review of that of those proposals. So that would go through a normal incidental take permit process. And while they might achieve coverage for a larger landscape, it probably wouldn't be, it would not be as quick as the self-certification idea. So we're laying all of these options out in the regulations.
Before you go to the next steps, which is where you are now, is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yes.
To what extent are these things that you are proposing here already covered by the MOU that we have with the Board of Forestry?
They're not.
They're not.
No. Certainly the objectives and intent that's within the joint policy are consistent with this. But that policy doesn't contain any specific procedures like these, and it does. And that policy was adopted, by the way, before the species was state listed.
Of course, but forest practice rules take a lot of this into consideration as it stands now. So you must be coordinating extremely closely with CDF.
That's
one
correct.
Would assume.
That's correct, and I believe it was 2000, the forest practice rules were amended with what were called the threatened impaired watershed rules. and they did elevate and improve protections relative to anadromous fish. They mainly did that for Class 1, which are the fish-bearing watercourses. They did nothing more for Class 2s, which are the non-fish-bearing watercourses.
Are you going to drop the Class 3s as well?
And they did nothing for Class 3s. These measures for self-certification enhanced the measures for the larger Class 2 watercourses, those that run all year long.
I was chairman of forest practice for 6 years.
I'm aware of that. Not everybody may have your breadth of experience, my reason. And the Class 3s, which are ephemeral watercourses, we are adding measures there that we believe will still facilitate timber harvesting there, but manage the sediment from those systems. And then road measures, while they have the forest practice rules have improved quite a bit over the last 5 years, and I might add that implementation by timber companies has improved a lot over the past
week. Indeed it has. One of the real problems with all of this is adding time to getting a THP
right.
approved. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think this will do that?
I think the streamlined approach, if somebody would choose to choose that, it would add no time at all.
You realize how imperative that is. I mean, it's imperative that we protect the resource. Don't get me wrong on that one. That's my own personal first and foremost. But
sure.
Having said that, the timber industry is not exactly robust in this state.
No. And market timing is important for them, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, you put together a THP, you got to get that product to the market. Mm-hmm. You got to do it now.
Right.
And so you cannot get engaged in a long process, which pre-screening, pre-approval of methodologies is incredibly important to these people.
This streamlined approach is unique for us. We've never done this before. I have to say that not all the timber companies are embracing the idea yet.
Well, not all the timber companies operate at the same level either.
Right. We have also done this, frankly, with an eye towards trying to get on their side of the table and look at what it looks like from them. So we've engaged in very extensive GIS analyses of scores of timber harvesting plans that have been recently submitted to evaluate the consequences on the ground for them in terms of acres, board feet, and while some of the timber companies will tell you that this is going to take 35-45% of their land out of production, I'm here to tell you it's a single-digit percentage. And I've invited them to show me where my data is wrong. They haven't done it.
Okay. How have you guys, it said that next steps are to coordinate with the Board of Forestry. To what extent have you made presentations to the Forest Practice Committee and gotten their input, because they think they're trying to regulate the same thing?
That's right. We have not yet briefed them. They're going to get essentially...
It would be a good idea.
We're scheduled to do that in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. And also we are going to give a briefing as well to the Regional Water Quality Control Board, because they think they regulate that.
Is there only one region? Or are you talking regions?
There's only one that's important with respect to coho salmon.
Right.
Right.
We are the regulators on this, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
that's our story, Mr. Hattori, and we're sticking to it.
We're sticking to it.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, we had pushed it down.
Yes. So Director Broderick kind of set out this work plan. We would meet with you to let you know that we haven't forgotten the charge you gave us, that we are working actively on it. We are also going to reach out to some of the other organizations who have a stake in this. And we're going to finish these draft regulations. We actually believe they're very close to those that we would be submitting for formal rulemaking. There are some technical areas that need some more attention. Some of these problems, Mr. Rogers, you well understand are difficult to figure out how to implement, especially in a streamlined way where they don't have to consult with us. But I think that we have what we believe are reasonable answers to the problems that have been identified through meeting with people. So we have some technical matters to develop on the regulations as they stand now. Department of Forestry and Fire Protection has some suggestions relative to the roads parts, and I need to get together with Deputy Director Schneider on that. And we also, of course, need our legal staff to review it, because the authors so far have been biologists, and we need our legal staff to help us with the rulemaking language.
Have you heard that before, Sonka?
Yeah,
no. Yeah. We currently anticipate that we would be prepared to get busy on the formal rulemaking process either late this fall or certainly I would think by the end of the year, unless we encounter something we don't expect. So I can certainly go into these flow charts if you want, or we can call that good.
No. Okay.
Thank you for your good work.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mark. Next item is update on the PFMC recent meeting.
Good morning, still commissioners. I'm going to present an overview of the results of the September PMFC meeting. Of significance, particularly in your interests, is the Magnuson-Stevens Act reauthorization. That's open. That was kind of one of the items you may want to discuss is the commission's comments on that whole process, because it affects you directly. Yeah. But the council voted through the PSMFC, the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. They also have sent comments in the reauthorization, mostly focused on making sure that the toolbox is full, considering this act serves the entire continent and Pacific for fisheries. And the biggest issue is making sure we have all the tools to deal with all these various fisheries issues. There is a Senate Bill 1549 by Senator Smith on whiting quota management, which would remove the authority from the regional councils to Congress. The council sent a letter opposing that idea. They want to keep it at the regional council level. The rest of it was more typical business. There were some in-season adjustments to trawl fisheries to try and protect some problems with petrel sole and canary rockfish, mostly expanding the rockfish conservation areas in north of latitude 36. There were some other minor adjustments to commercial fishing to stay within quotas established by them. There was a bycatch reduction action that was adopted. The other key one is essential fish habitat amendment. They adopted the draft language for public review and comment will now go to the National Marine Fisheries Service for public comment and review the regulations. That includes that Channel Islands piece we did and the RIGS designated habitat of special concern, and then all the other designations, including trawl issues. And if you have questions, go ahead and ask. I think Mr. Raftkin had some concerns about that the last time in Bishop, I guess it was. It is now open for public review through the service, and so folks can comment on the regulations. The other items were scheduling the 2007-2008 biennial groundfish management specifications regulations. They're just scheduling that. The next meeting in November will set the initial ABCs, the allowable biological catches and optimum yield levels, which are, of course, drive everything, and that they'll be developed and presented formally at the April PMFC or PFMC meeting with final action in June, just to give you an idea of their timing. Again, I can't overemphasize the ABCs and OYs drive everything on that. There also were discussions about stock rebuilding plan and all the stock assessments. They have done 23 stock assessments of late, a very ambitious schedule, and they're just now, all that data is now percolating to the council, and they'll be talking more about the specific results and unresolved issues at the November meeting. November meeting is going to be a significant meeting, by the way, if you're interested in attending. The other issue they dealt with is the highly migratory species. The council approved for public review draft protocols for reviewing exempted fishing permits. The reason that's significant, there's some concern about expanded drift net and gill net fishing, which could impact sea turtles. So they're dealing with that issue. And the issue about big eye tuna overfishing resolution has been postponed until the November meeting. There was a declaration of it being overfished. The final results are being held over till November now. That has some significant impacts. The next issue they dealt with was salmon. The Klamath River Klamath River Fall Chinook Stock Recruitment Analysis has been developed for the fisheries management plan. They're going to hold it over to give the chance for the Klamath Council to weigh in on it. So that'll be also dealt with at the November meeting or discussed. And as you know, with your in-river issues and the commercial fishing issues you wrestled with in Oakland, the finale, that is a significant issue also. The other key one is marine protected areas. As you know, at the last meeting, they adopted the EFHs, which were a part of this. The Channel Islands fishing regulations were discussed that were adopted under that EFH, and three options were had come from the public review. One was no regulations under the National Marine Sanctuaries Act authority. The other is recommended that National Marine Sanctuaries Act regulations implemented under what they called Option 2 and Channel Islands National Marine Reserve Area. And then three was implemented through the EFH. The action will be taken at the November council meeting. Again, this is this whole issue about whether the council has the authority to set these rules or whether the Sanctuaries Act should be the right venue. It's still a highly debated issue. So far, the service has accepted and is allowing the council to move down the path they've gone, which is to allow the council to establish these reserves and not the sanctuaries.
They took the first.
Yeah, they took the first swipe at it.
Yeah.
Right. And they're internally, the National Marine Fisheries Service is still internally trying to resolve what their preference is to the approach, and they have not resolved it yet. But since there's a process in place that some argue, and it may appear to work, they're letting it continue. But we don't know yet what they'll come back with. And that's essentially it for now. It was kind of a quiet council meeting. The November meeting is the first week of November in San Diego, just before it actually overlaps the commission meeting in Santa Barbara. If you're interested in witnessing some of that, I can provide the information and contacts that you may want to chat with our state representatives, by the way. Any questions?
Questions, Tom? Thank you.
If I may, just to make a comment, what is going to go on at that November meeting is an understatement in terms of its importance, particularly with respect to the interests of this commission in the Channel Islands as well. I think we need to stay very close to that.
Yeah, and if the commissioners, I'm not sure how to help the commission on staying on top of this. We did bring you their schedule to try and so you at least you're aware of when you need to enter these things based on their scheduling. But if there's anything we can do to help you stay connected with that process and provide input at a timely manner, we're open.
I listened in to the, didn't participate, but I listened into the conference call the last time here, a week ago or so, 10 days ago. There's a lot going on in these meetings.
It's a whirlwind, none of them are lightweight issues, and they do so much affect how the state deals with a lot of these fisheries.
Now, do they know our position or opinion on Channel Islands issues? Or
yes.
Okay. Maria's been telling.
No, Maria has been has made that very clear.
Yeah, what
and
Maria
we'll be there
did,
again in November.
The thing that Maria did was basically take the commission's direction that was adopted several years ago, and we shoved it down the EFH throat because we thought it was the most appropriate venue. We'd rather keep it in the council venue.
Absolutely.
Rather than the sanctuaries, for reasons we were also clearly why we stated.
It's a rather long list of reasons.
Yes. And Secretary Chrisman has sent the service a letter explaining their reasons. So we're very clear and above board on why we did what we did. And we are still continuing down that path until we're shown differently. Now, there's a lot of groups, including sanctuaries, that completely disagree with our position. But that's something that will be debated at the November meeting and onward.
Understand this, but this commission retains not only the Marine Subcommittee, but retains a very intense interest in that. And if you detect any if you get any pre-knowledge here as to what where you think they're going to go, and if they're going to go some other way than this commission wants, we would want to know that the moment you know that.
Second we hear that, we'll pass that on.
We'll show. For sure.
Mr. Aptigan?
Mr. President, member.
Sorry, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. President, members of the commission, thank you. First of all, thanks for putting on this on the agenda. We got a letter from the commission sent to the director that essentially says commission would also appreciate being informed in a timely manner when the PFMC will be considering actions which will be affecting state management so commission can discuss the issues and determine that if we need to provide any policy direction. This is exactly where we're coming to, and it gets back to the essential fish habitat and the battle that went on at the commission. At the council, Pacific Council. And this is going back to our discussions in June. And really, the whole focus of where we were was not the actions that were taken, but this is something that needs to be discussed. And again, just like the budget, bring it out in a public discussion, and all of a sudden you're going to get support behind what you're doing. And what happened there is we got something that was pulled out that was not in the California delegation. I see Sankey turn around because we're going to disagree on some of this stuff, but we've been very open about it. We just need to make sure that when these decisions are made, that you are the ones that are standing behind the decisions and that they're made in the light of day. That's exactly where we're coming from on this. We really thank you for putting the Pacific Council agenda items on your agenda so that they are discussed. Exactly what Sankey was saying is these are terribly complex issues, okay? Are you going to be able to get involved? No. Probably the Marine Subcommittee is the venue for that. But the thing is, when it gets out here and it gets on the forum within the commission, all of a sudden everybody gets a look at it and you get a much, much better, a broader view. And again, when the things come out and reach the light of day, you're going to get public support on them. We thought this is the appropriate venue. That was the discussion on what happened with EFH and the council. It probably is the appropriate venue. I'm not sure whether it's essential fish habitat, but again, if that comes up here at the commission meetings, you're going to get support behind it instead of people going, hey, we've got a real problem with what you're doing, and actually it's the way it's being done, not necessarily what was done there. So something on that very same issue happened this past Friday. You're going to get another letter in Western Outdoor News from one of the seats on the council. There was a reallocation of 2 tons of canary rockfish. The 2 tons of canary rockfish were reallocated up to an Oregon fishery. You've got 3 dogfish fishermen in Oregon that are going to have plenty of bycatch for the next year, and this was something that was done that did not show up at the California delegation meeting. And like I said, I've got one of the seats on the council has already discussed it with the manager of the marine region. And again, the problem is not necessarily what's being done, but the thing is, bring people into the process on how this is going. Why was this not brought up in the allocation committee? If we can see what's going on there, you're going to have a lot more people behind you on this stuff. And again, if I underline anything, these are policy decisions. These are policy decisions that should be set in this room. And it's going to be difficult jumping on the horse and catching up with the horse. But the thing is, we absolutely respect you for putting this on the agenda. And I know you're going to have a difficult time getting on here, but boy, thank you very much. These are things that as they come up right now, they will affect fishing in California in the years to come. And, we wonder why we have a decline in license sales. That reallocation of 2 tons of canary rockfish, you think, it's a dogfish fishery up in Oregon. What it essentially is going to mean is going to be taking recreational rockfish anglers off the water for 2 months. And were you going to do something like it? Is there a reason behind it? There very well might be. That reason didn't make public. You're going to get a black eye in Western Outdoor News again. I'm assuming they're printing the letter. I talked to the council seat Tuesday night at a dinner. And this is stuff that shouldn't happen. And you know, we really need to have it out in the open. And the bottom line of what I'm saying here right now is thank you for putting on this on the agenda. We understand it's difficult. You know, we have a hard time staying up on top of this ourselves. And like I said, this council seat saw this. He got it after the fact, and this is something that shouldn't happen to him, let alone to here. So thanks for getting engaged in this stuff. It is complicated. It's complex. But the thing is, in order to put together good fishing, we're going to have the department's expertise coming to you and saying, hey, look, these are the options that we've got, which direction we go. You set the policy, and then you can't micromanage it. But once you set the policy, go in that direction. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Next item is update on surf perch, sport fishing regs.
Yes, commissioners, we were asked to, at the request of Mr. Bob Strickland, with the sympathy of Commissioner Rogers, asking for a surf perch back. We have, and then the commission specifically assigned Marcy Aremko with the job of figuring out whether that's doable or not. The good news is, aside from her many duties, she has managed to look at the history of the fishery and the decision that was made at the time and how it was made. And the good news, I think we found, I'll just call it, probably an error in assessment that it appears to have been unnecessary to include the waters south of San Francisco in that bag limit reduction. The preliminary analysis that she's completed looks like there's a legitimate concern in the bay, and it looks like where we're heading is what we'll do is probably come back as soon as we can with a recommendation to enhance the bag limits for the coastal surf perch group south of San Francisco, maybe north. That's still being looked at because it appears it probably grabbed more than we needed to deal with the bay issue, which was really driving the issue more than anything else. So I think that's good news for Mr. Strickland and Mr. Rogers and those others who like to
being a surf perch person. But also, If I observe in my area the number of fishermen, recreational fishermen, who are fishing along the beach and actually in float tubes and in kayaks and whatnot, they're after surf perch. Yes, if they get a halibut, that's great, but they're really after surf perch. This is going to have a good effect.
Yeah,
there are a lot of people involved in this.
Yeah, the good news is that the five fish limit, most folks don't catch five. But as Mr. Strickland and others have pointed out, it's a perception. You know, with nowadays, if you're going to fill your car with a tank of gas, which will cost you $40-$50, and you know, you got to have some expectation that you're going to have a fulfilling experience. And some 10 is more fulfilling potentially, even though the odds are they won't catch it, than others. And that's part of it, is giving hope. And I think we can provide hope without impacting the resource here.
Do you have a timeline for the initial statement?
I'm negotiating that. It's, you know, you've heard our speeches. It's workload. I would like to say we can come to you in November, but I'm working on that right now. If not, I sure hope by December.
We see, Bob, this is a marine biologist who's doing regulations.
I was afraid you'd pick up on that. But
this, I mean, the commission directed the department over a year ago to provide us with an initial statement. We get an update, and I appreciate that because Marcy did an excellent job in sorting through the data, showing the errors of the way, but yet no initial statement. And to me, it could have been done 11 months ago. But
speaking of regulation cycles, I know one of the goals of the commission has been to try and consolidate and stick to the basic regulation cycles. Given that Mr. Trainer, Executive Secretary, when's the next sport fish reg cycle?
Starts August of 2006.
August. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the logical thing, not trying to make an excuse for not getting to this to you sooner, but the logical thing, because we've all been talking about workload, is to throw this in the hopper for the August cycle. If you really want it sooner than that, we can probably do it sooner. It's your choice. I'm just saying we're just about ready, but there's some logic to waiting for the August cycle, and I'm not looking for an excuse to buy more time.
No, I'm comfortable with putting things into a regular cycle if, in fact, things stay on timelines. Yeah. You don't want this simply to be symptomatic of some other larger problem.
Right.
Right. I'm fine with that otherwise.
Next item is an update on abalone.
By the way, commissioners, Gary Stacy, the regional manager of the Marine Region, would normally be here, but he just went under oral surgery yesterday, or the day before that, and we talked him out of trying to come here and blabber away under the influence of medication. So, I've been trying to cover for him. No comment. The only update we really have on the abalone is we continue at the commissioner's prodding to enhance the data available for the abalone management plan. We did manage to get some dives in with some of the commercial divers, the former commercial divers, urchin divers, I'm not sure exactly the makeup, on San Miguel Island, the one island where there appears to be some pretty healthy populations still in Southern California section. We did do some dives out there with help. The good news is there are some decent populations out there still. They have improved. We have some time series data. They have actually improved since the closure, so things are looking good there. And we will continue to collect more data, but I just wanted to give you an update. We did manage to get some dives out there. I think Mr. Rogers had really encouraged us to focus on that area. And so we've gotten some, and we're going to continue to get some more, weather permitting. And that's about it on the update.
We have some individuals that would like to provide comments. Steve Reebuck, Christopher Voss, and then Paul Weakland.
Good morning. My name is Steve Reebuck. I live in San Luis Obispo, and I'm here today representing the California Abalone Association. What I just passed out to you is a continuation of the experimental fishery plan that I introduced in San Luis Obispo last month. The commercial divers are represented by the California Abalone Association. It's a nonprofit educational entity. About 3 weeks ago, we had a general meeting with about half of the abalone permittees. There were approximately 100 at the time abalone was closed in May of 1997. In the draft I handed out to you, you'll note some red highlighted segments. Those are areas that we're still working on. We consider this draft not quite complete. I'd say it's about 90% complete of our ideas, but we wanted to share it with you today, along with the department, in good faith that you'll look at it and feed back to us your ideas. We do need your assistance. Item number one has to do with participation, and we've included all 100 former permittees. There's been some individuals who have died and have retired, and we don't think there would be 100 divers, but in fairness, we want to include everyone. Item two is a code of conduct. This is something that's being developed in New Zealand, and it has to do with divers agreeing to a set of principles and protocols on how they're going to conduct their activities and their dive and fishing businesses. And we think it's a great idea, and we're working on that particular language currently. We have another meeting tomorrow in Santa Barbara. The basis for this plan, I'll call it, is the work by Dr. Jeremy Prince from Australia. He's come up with what he calls the essential fishery knowledge. Essentially, the fishermen that are participating in a fishery have a lot of knowledge that's outside the biological community. And there's an attempt at work here through what's called the Barefoot Ecologist to bring people that are participating into the scientific realm. And I think it's a good idea. I'm going to skip ahead here to item number six. We are recommending or proposing some numbers of individual abalone to be harvested at two locations, 15,000 individuals at San Miguel Island and 2,000 currently at the Farallones. Now, we think that this is supportable by current data that's being we didn't hear it today, but we've seen some of this most recent data. The Farallones is a problem because we don't have good data out there, and we do have approximately 10 divers that specialize in that area. We've assigned them as a subcommittee now to help us come up with some numbers for the Farallones.
You got to be tough guys to dive at the Farallones.
There's a couple in the audience, yeah, I guarantee you.
Whoa,
they are. So we've for in a draft setting, we suggested 2,000 individuals out there. Some think it could be considerably higher. We've also suggested here a proportional ITQ, an IFQ, an individual fishing quota. What this means is that every participant in the fishery will get an equal part of whatever that total allowable catch is. And out of 17,000 animals, that means 100 guys would get 170 fish. Not a lot, but based on the value of the fish and the possibility over time that these quotas are adjusted, it provides a part of a livelihood. Number seven has to do with the seasons. We're suggesting a 7-month season. There's consideration to even cut that down more. Justification for this is that the abalones during the winter months tend to suffer more because of the weather conditions, lack of food. By springtime, there's kelp, and they feed, they grow, and the yield is better. So we're maximizing the value of the animal by waiting till later in the year. Number eight is kind of going back in time to raise the size limit for commercial abalone to 8 inches. This is the size prior to 1959. Mm-hmm. And again, it has to do with yield, maturity of the animals. They're giving them additional time to spawn. Number nine, ports. There will only be two ports allowed for offloading abalone. That would be Santa Barbara and Half Moon Bay. This will aid law enforcement and data collection. Number 10 is kind of a unique idea. We've been kicking this around with the department for going on about 15 years, the idea of tags. We've set a value on these tags at $10 each. So at 17,000 animals that we're proposing to start with, that's $170,000 for monitoring and research. And if I could have a couple more minutes, please. Number 11 has to do with another New Zealand concept called an annual catch entitlement. And this would allow the individuals that have purchased these tags but maybe don't want to go fishing to transfer those tags to another qualified individual. What this does is that it helps them earn a little money. The next item is number 12. It's going to be the permit fee. We don't know what that might be. But if they're allowed to trade those tags and not fish, then they're not going in debt to buy their permits. 12 I just touched on. 13 is a logbook. There's a number of important components to that logbook, and I won't go over them because it's in front of you. Number 14 has to do with observers and training divers. We want divers, again, to be like this Barefoot Ecologist program, participants in the data collection. And we see that through the fees and the tag fees, the permits, the taxes and such, there's money in there for the department's work. There's money in there to monitor and there's money in there to train individuals. So we see this as a positive economic impact for the state of California. With that, I'm going to introduce my associate, Chris Voss. He's a 17-year veteran of the commercial fishery and has a bachelor's degree in marine biology. And we'll be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
My name is Chris Voss, and do the commissioners have any questions about what you've just been presented with?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, then I'd like to make a statement. this proposal is designed so that the most important aspect of it is the sustainability of the resource. Okay, and then with that as the guiding concern, we're going to tax ourselves to sustain also the management scheme that we're putting into place, the management plan. So it's described as experimental because I think that kind of system doesn't exist in the state of California. So we're trying to put in place a plan that not only is self-guided, self-funded, self-sustaining, rational, but inexpensive to the state. And hopefully will actually generate funds for the state because it's going to allow a population of fishermen to become more successful economically in the long run. Initially, the TAC and the ITQ is set at a very low level. So it's just enough funds to generate for us to implement this process, implement and hire a competent biologist to oversee the data that we collect, and an accounting firm to keep track of the tag system that we're going to develop that already exists in New Zealand. So we're going to use a lot of the information they've already been able to acquire. So we're going to model it after other successful TAC-ITQ fisheries, or IFQ. I don't think that one exists that's in the state of California that's properly run. A TAC IFQ fishery. In Alaska, where I've spent 17 years fishing, there are successful fisheries managed on that format, and the people that participate in them and the people that oversee them and manage them are now making statements to the effect that those are successful solutions that should be incorporated in other places. So I had a discussion with Deputy Director Sonke, and he felt that our presenting this as an experimental fishery might be an overreach for the reason that it's not necessarily an experimental fishery, in that abalone was a fishery before, and we're just planning on doing it again. But I would suggest to the Commission that the experimental aspect of what we're proposing is the actual plan itself. So I think that's about all I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to say, Mr. Voss and Mr. Reebok, on my behalf, I appreciate you working on this and putting together, you know, the proposal. The commission at the last meeting did direct the department to include the proposed experimental fishery at San Miguel Island as part of the working draft, and for you to come back, you know, within 6 weeks with something like this, I think really helps the commission and the department in developing that draft. So we appreciate your
I really agree with that. I think this is a very constructive and very interesting approach. I also enjoyed reading that email from Terry Lilly. That was interesting.
Yeah, this is actually, I mean, it's actually getting to come to some conclusion, I think. I mean, it's good work. It's good work. You filled in a lot of the data and the gaps.
Mr. Weakland, followed by Gary Verhagen.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. First of all, I'd like to take a mention to what Mr. Rogers said.
about the Fairlawns being a dangerous place to dive. More people are killed every day on the highways of California than have ever been bit by sharks at the Fairlawns. If you're afraid of dying, get off the freeway. Less hazardous diving at the Fairlawns.
I've probably been underwater longer than you have.
Yes, sir. I'm not denying that. And if you don't know, I have a little nickname. I'm known as a sissy bitch, and I go out there and dive the Fairlawns.
That's your name, too?
Forget it.
Move on.
First, I would like to take issue to your abalone recovery and management plan that has taken over 10 years to develop. We experimented with abalone fishing well on in the 1800s and all the way through the 1900s. How can it now be an experiment? I would like to read to you a comment that was responded to me in your document about catch per unit of effort. The fishing game has never used catch per unit of effort as a measurement device in the assessment of abalones. All right, here is the response from the department of why catch per unit of effort is not used. CPUE is not a reliable indicator of abundance in sedentary species such as abalone. Assumptions of using CPUE, including random redistribution of stock after fishing and randomness in the way the stock is fished, neither of these assumptions apply to abalone. Thus, its use is inappropriate. So right away, we have a problem with the methodology because CPU has never been used in the estimates of abalone. There is our underlying problem. If you would use CPUE, which is used in all other resource assessments, we would not be having this problem. But you have deleted some of the most important ways of assessing the resource. Now, in your document, serial depletion definition has now been changed. Why is it changed? No explanation. That's what you keep doing. It's a living document, so we're going to continue to change the definitions. Not appropriate, not acceptable. Confidence bounds on your estimates. Your confidence bounds are very low. Timelines. You have one timeline for recovery, which is 10 years. Well, that has already passed by. We have completed that. You have another timeline from implementation. Implementation will be immediate. Done. Criteria 3. Criteria 3 is 6,600 abalones per haw. Do you know what haw is? It's a hectare. Are we familiar with that? You are familiar with acres, aren't you? Well, 6,600 abalones per acre equals 800 abalones per hectare. So why would the scientists want to confuse this number? Why don't they just say 800 abalones per acre? Because they want to confuse, not clarify, the situation. Now, alternative one in your document. Alternative one wants limited fishing without full achievement of criteria 3. Well, wait a minute. Criteria 3 is the foundation upon which this plan has been based. Yet, there has been no compromise on this number of criteria 3. The department will not compromise, even on their recent surveys. They are not willing to compromise on a number that is not scientific. This number was pulled out of the air in other places. There is no scientific reference to this number anywhere. Limited fishing without achievement of criteria 3. Well, this admits that criteria 3 is flawed and not necessary for recovery or sustainable fishing. And still has no violation of the ARMP. They say if you choose alternative 1, you're going to be violating the ARMP. How can that be? A minimum size limit of 7 3/4 inches has already been established biologically and over a number of years as being the sustainable size limit. Now, if we would, as I have suggested for many years, raise the size limit to 7 3/4 inches throughout the state of California for the harvest of red abalones, you'll be leaving a lot more standing stock on the bottom. Your reproductive potential is greatly enhanced at 7 3/4 inches, what has been proven over time. Now, Criteria 2 says that a total allowable catch is not scientifically based nor biologically necessary. This is true. It's another opinionated concept. Again, alternative 2 reduces criteria 3 levels and new methodology or the creation of a new criteria 4. So criteria three has a lot of problems. Let's go to alternative three. Alternative three, without full achievement of criteria three. So alternative three, alternative one, two, and three want to modify and change criteria three, which is your 800 abalones per acre. So the first three alternatives right away are flawed because they want to take your base number of 800 abalones per acre and modify it. So why are we even having this number if it's going to be modified through the first three alternatives in your document? Now, alternative four is the true choice. We had a functioning fishery. We had a management plan that worked for many years until the introduction of the disease withering syndrome. And why has none of the management plans ever been formulated to account for the possibility or the chance of introduction of disease? We know that the outplanting of pike in Lake Davis, your outplantings, these hatcheries, you guys aren't getting it. Alternative five.
Wrap it up now.
Alternative five, why punish fishermen for a lack of enforcement, research mistakes, mismanagement, and failed leadership or stewardship of our resource agencies? Alternative six, a complete closure. That would be fair and equitable. Alternative seven says they want to develop an interim plan. The interim plan was the moratorium started in 1993. Alternative seven is already done. Now, your decision tables. Once you meet your criteria three, which has to be modified if you accept alternative one, two, or three, you now go to your decision tables. Well, no one has explained anything about the decision tables, and none of the questions about the decision tables are even included in the comments. Your decision tables right away are a catch-22 for failure. You were able to use those decision tables and manipulate and massage them in a method where you can assume anything you want. The facts are like, don't worry about that. Now, what about all the concepts of the Farallon Islands? Well, the Farallon Islands is a perfect test study site. No one dives there but a few divers and no sport divers. So why would our scientists, if they are motivated, if they are determined to have a good study site, that's the one to use? And this fear, this cowardice, oh, there's sharks in every ocean of the world. You know what sets a white shark apart from all other sharks? It's found in all the oceans of the world. And this excuse of the Farallons being a dangerous place, it's all dangerous. You know, we've had more fatalities from decompression sickness and embolism than ever from shark attack. So, I have a lot more to say, but thank you.
Mr. Verhagen?
Commissioners, my name's Gary Verhagen, commercial diver for 21 years. And the gentleman that talked about the Farallons, I'm just up here to say that I'll participate in research. The latter 10 years of my diving out there, I got 80% of my time in the water at the Southeast Island. Your game warden and the Point Reyes Bird Observatory documented all of this. So if you want to look, go look. The paperwork's there. In terms of white sharks, the first 10 years of diving, I may have seen one a year. The last 2 years, I saw 1 to 5 a day, and I'm still here. And again, I'd like to help out if I can. My partner at the time, Mike Kitahara, is also excellent on the area. I can tell you this, in 21 years of diving out there, I haven't seen the whole place, and I haven't seen the same place as Mike dove that I dove at the island. It's an awful lot of territory, and these off-the-wall shots of doing research should have been done in the last 8 years, not at the last minute. Anyhow, thank you. Mr. Trainer, I'd like to say hi to you. I haven't seen you since 1997.
Good to see you,
Take
sir.
Take care.
Thank you. That's it on the speakers. If there's any discussion that the commission may want about the timeline for bringing the document back.
Yeah, what is scheduled now? I thought it was at the. Yeah, I thought it was at the November.
Well, that's.
I was just wondering. Yeah.
That was the discussion at the last meeting with the anticipation for Santa Barbara. I didn't hear the status of that document with the inclusion of the new data being collected by the department, whether they will have it available for commission and public review
well in advance of the Santa Barbara meeting, or how long it would take the department to include the draft fishery proposal or plan that was submitted today?
The department understood my reluctance to move forward on any abalone plan without the biomass data.
Right. Yeah, there's, I mean, given the expectations we understand, that's one of the things I wanted to ask. There's a couple issues. One is the data. We can provide off-commission process data to date, but I'm not sure whether we've reached the bar you set, so I can't really answer the question whether we'll be ready for the Santa Barbara meeting. Based on our workloads right now, there's very little chance, especially when you include...
Then perhaps it should be put off.
Well, and then the other issue is the... I appreciate the commercial abalone diver fishermen working on this plan. What I was going to ask is what your expectations were relative to their plan. It still needs some work. I'm very impressed with the work they've done to date. If you want this to be literally an option in the abalone plan, it will not be ready by November.
No, but couldn't we like cut and paste, meaning... If their suggestions are different from ours and item number 1 through 16, we could then have an explanation and an option. Some of them are the same. I mean, there's a few things, a lot of important things that they have. But
I think what Sankey's saying, though, is that the department needs time to vet.
Of course they do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
We're close.
There's
so
very interesting proposals, but some of their criteria we're going to have to discuss.
Sure.
Because if you want it incorporated verbatim...
Well, and if November doesn't work, I'm just speaking for myself.
Yeah.
I can't speak for the rest of the
There's no way.
But remember, I would like to see this thing, done right? So
yes.
Would you. I understand
that. Was
that
a message I got.
Yeah, and I think what these gentlemen have produced is really very interesting.
It is. I'm impressed.
And I would like to see this integrated, perhaps, as an alternative or as something that goes on at the same time.
Yeah, and I think we're real close, I mean, to opening up a fishery in San Miguel and Farallones if we do it right. And they've been waiting 8 or 9 years, and if it's one more month to get the data right, or 2 more months, I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
to do it right.
Thinking about some previous discussions about our interest in consolidating regulation packages and making our workloads a little more practical is, you know, the logical place, because an abalone fishery... I hesitate to use the word experimental because that has meaning in our laws and codes. But really, having a limited fishery is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
there's
call
no,
it that.
Yeah. And because we'll also have to figure out the recreational share of that pie.
Right.
The natural regulation cycle is actually the August, the one that we talked about relative to the surf perch, is the August cycle for regulations because we'd have to adopt regulations and all that. So what I'm saying is let's get this plan right in a time early enough to have the plan adopted and then initiate the regulatory cycle, whatever turns out to be appropriate, so that you can adopt it during your normal sport commercial reg cycle is basically what I'm pitching at you.
But the plan would come back when?
It would...
January, February, or...?
Hopefully December, January. Okay. I'm not sure how many wrinkles we still have to iron out, but... you know, it couldn't come to us, Bob, help me with the timing. We'd have to probably adopt this plan no later than the February meeting, if you have one, to have time, to have clarity what...
For regulatory
clarity. Well, let's shoot for December, and if we can't, we'll do it in January,
December
obviously.
Is at least
December
in the realm of possibility, given what your expectations are. Yeah. November, there's...
Remember, we're doing this,
assuming
what biomass
data is going to be there.
Yeah, and that's...
we're not dragging our feet.
On it.
You know, is what I want to emphasize. We're trying to incorporate what they've suggested, make sure the data is right from the department, and get a plan together that works.
Right. I mean,
this isn't just delay.
The last thing I want to do is, quote, we ram this thing through, and you set up a regulatory cycle, and we come back saying it doesn't work.
I don't want that, so...
Right.
Okay. would.
I mean, we've come a long ways. We still got a ways to go, but I heard your message pretty straight there. It's let's do this right.
Yeah, December.
And again, in the sense of the normal regulatory cycle, the August one makes sense in terms of regs. That might follow from.
Well, let's see what we have in December and January, and see the efficacy of all of this, and the extent to which we get an integrated, limited fishery, if that's the term.
Yeah.
Which I'd love to see.
Okay,
Commissioner Rogers.
Abalone
is the first all limited entry fishery in California.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that with the data that the department's collecting, maybe they can see if it'll change some of their recommendations, their alternatives.
I hope that's
true.
Yeah,
that's what I would like to see happen.
I hope that's true.
Yeah, as a point of clarification real quickly, I mean, I hope you understand because you've had the presentations, the 6,600, 6,000 thing was simply drawn from existing.
Exactly.
In the document, fully recognize that's just a pick based on some numbers. What's interesting at San Miguel, we've recently had densities higher than that.
Yeah,
I know
talked
that.
About
so,
a
know,
regional change on it.
I've stayed close to it, Zunke.
Okay.
I know that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I appreciate your attitude here. This is good.
Cool.
Okay.
Okay.
Our next items then is the receipt of commission informational items. The first one scheduled was from the subcommittee of the Al Tauscher Policy Advisory Committee. Commissioner Flores attended that meeting but is not here. Assistant Executive Director Mr. Fisher was also present, and if you'd like that report at this time, we can provide it.
We can wait. We can wait. John, we can wait.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do it in November.
Anything pressing that we need
you
to
hear? You
want
me to provide it? No, just no, I could take a minute and talk about a few things. There was Forest Service discussion of a road closure issues on the El Dorado National Forest. There was an update from the U.S. Sportsman's Alliance Trailblazer Adventure Program, and this is an interesting project because there is Boy Scout camporee that the Sportsman's Alliance groups are going to get involved in sponsoring in October in the Modesto area. And there will be 450 Boy Scouts participating in that, and there will be lots of presentations and opportunities involving outdoor activities, archery, shotgun, rifle shooting, things, you know, outdoor activities in that. And we discussed legislative issues, we discussed fishing issues and department functions. Mr. Mastrop gave a rather lengthy update of the budget situation, and we talked about that earlier during this meeting. And to summarize everything, we're looking at a next meeting in December, and there's a potential of involving that budget workshop, but I also understand from this meeting that we may want to approach that in a different fashion. So,
thank
in
you.
A nutshell, that's the summary.
Thank you, John.
And, you know, the next item was the update on United Anglers' request that was made at the last meeting regarding a blue ribbon task force regarding the department's budget, but I think, you know, we had a discussion earlier this morning about the department's willingness to come before the Al Tauscher meeting, but we're going to expand that now to include as many commissioners as possible and also as many of our constituents as possible to receive that presentation and basically education. And we'll be working with the department in scheduling that. It may be a special commission meeting, and we'll move forward with that. There was an item that we wanted to bring up as staff, but before we get into that, I believe Commissioner Rogers wanted to.
I do, and let me preface this and it's with a statement that I have, in my relatively brief tenure here with the commission, I've been impressed with both the personal and professional qualities exhibited by John Ugret, so I'm not suggesting anything negative. Western Outdoor News published an article about two issues ago. It wasn't the last one. The last one I saw was 923, so it was the one before that, I think. Enumerating in the article some statements that John had made at the Central Coast, alleged to have made at the Central Coast MLPA meeting with respect to the nature of MPAs that would be coming out of the process. Since that thing was recorded, we can find out just exactly what did John say. The assertion in the article was that John said that all the MPAs that were going to come out of that would be no-take. And that would be an absolute contravention to what this commission thinks is going on here, and certainly what I, as a commissioner, think is going on here. So I think what I would request, if it's my commissioner's, fellow commissioner's pleasure, is a presentation by the department in November at the Santa Barbara meeting, and hopefully with the Marine Region, head of the Marine Region being able to speak without having dental problems, as to exactly what is the department thinking in this line. What did John say, and if that is what he said, why did he say that, and et cetera, et cetera. Because I found one of the problems here is that kind of an article, if it's off base or if it's on target, raises tremendous problems with respect to a very large constituency's view of our process in the MLP. The whole idea that this whole thing was a setup to just lock up the coastlines is out there, as we all know. I don't think that that's what's going on. But if this is what John said, it just feeds fuel to that fire. And we need to get those remarks and, in fact, the department in the Marine Region's feelings about this, because John, as you know, is a terrific guy, and he's in a very powerful seat as one of the drivers of the MLPA, and we need to understand what's going on.
Yeah, and I think one more thing, as somebody who's a big supporter of the, you know, MLPA and the process, I have never thought that at any point were we taking the position that there'd be no take in all of the MPAs that might be proposed. It wasn't in the legislation. It's not in the framework. Farther on down the line, there might be one or two that deserve it or require it. But if John said it, and if John believes that it's the intent of this commission, is the reason he said it, that has to be clarified by this commission, too. So I don't think John's just out of control or something. There's obviously he didn't say it, or there's a reason for him to think it. And I don't want us to be the reason why he thinks it. So let's get to that, too. Yeah.
Well, Saki will respond to, I think, what the actual intent was. But, Mr. Rogers, would you like once we find out exactly what was said and how to respond to it, because it was published in the Western Outdoor News, would you want some further clarification written to that, yeah, or submitted as an editorial type, response?
That's at the commission's pleasure, but yeah. But I that sort of thing may be precisely appropriate.
That's what I was wondering. Depending on what we find and how we, respond to it, I think we should get the clarification that this commission has a different position.
We were talking earlier about, yes, about the fact that we seem to self-immolate frequently.
Exactly.
And a lot of, yeah, it is based on lack of communications. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
And what we need to do is just every time we see something like this is just dispel that.
You have to counteract it.
But yeah, you have to do it aggressively. Mm-hmm. And you have to do it proactively. We can't just constantly react to this stuff, because you end up looking extremely suspicious.
Yeah, and just adding, because they've already reported bad things about me, so I better be the one who says it. The Western Outdoor News hasn't exactly treated this commission or the department fairly, and hasn't always given accurate information, nor has it treated even the constituency groups fairly and given accurate information sometimes. So I would think it would be important for us to correct the information in the Western Outdoor News and ask our constituent friends to help that happen so that bad information isn't going out. But let's make it clear that, they're not the New York Times.
Well, yeah, wherever you find it, though, I mean, a lie or an untruth left unchallenged becomes the truth for other people that read it for the first time.
Of course, so perception is the reality.
That's what I'm just responding to. Yep. We will take care of a rebuttal to that on behalf of the commission.
Yep.
This is an old issue. You know, journalists, and I agree, this is not a journalistic venue. The bottom line is we already have a full response, the corrections. John, quite honestly, is quite upset about the two stories. They were very inaccurate, took many things out of context, and we will send the commission basically John's response to those two articles. That's already been done. The trick is a venue. I mean, we have worked with numerous, I'll call professional journals and less so over the years, and Mark Twain had a famous saying about not picking a fight with somebody who buys ink by the barrel. We have had limited success over our history of getting things corrected, particularly in that venue. So we're looking for a venue, and I think answering to the commission, because you've got constituents who read that particular publication, wanting to know what the hell is really going on. And I think I am more than happy to come back and actually have John explain to you what in fact was said and the facts, because it was egregious.
Well, it may be the commission may be the venue, but also there's some other stakeholders in this room right now who, where the efficacy of this MLPA process is really important to everybody.
Yes, absolutely.
And the extent to which the process itself is impugned is a very serious problem for a whole bunch of stakeholders, not just this commission.
And perhaps if a clarification discussion of those, the facts versus the innuendos and the accuracies, maybe the commission is a forum that you can get somebody to cover that story and have a second chance at actually getting it reported accurately, as opposed to starting an ink war, which we've tried and generally doesn't work. I want to be effective, and I would more than happy to explain to the commission, because it was bad. There was another example where we're actually seeking libel. It's a libelous issue. So we've had some problems there, and we've got some really irresponsible individuals out there, not naming the Western Outdoor News as one of them, but we do need to set the record straight, because it can really harm this process.
Sure.
We've got a lot of folks investing serious personal time and effort. It's actually going very well. The working group has gotten past the goals and objectives, and they're getting ready to deal with actual citing and all that. I'm impressed. I mean, the success, they're actually, you know, they're not, there's consensus doesn't exist, but they all agree it's still worth working on, and I hate to see irresponsible
misinformation
undermine that, and we're frustrated with it. We would love to come and explain and have you answer any questions you have about what John or the department, where we stand and everything, because we've been pretty clear. We are stewarding this effort along with a lot of other folks. We are not guiding it. We are simply helping those folks get through to provide advice to not only the department but ultimately the commission. That has always been our position.
Yeah, the legislature told us to do it.
That's it.
Okay.
I like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Tom, can you be real quick?
2 seconds. We saw the article, and exactly what Commissioner Rogers is saying. It cuts to the core of what we do, and there are people that are engaged in the process, and when you see stuff like that, it hurts the legitimate people when they're trying to make the thing move forward. If you have it on the agenda at the meeting in November, I will do what I can to get legitimate outdoor press and media there to the event and make sure that we get broad coverage of it, and it's not just one venue.
Tom, that's really excellent. Yeah. Thank you. That may answer that problem.
Don't hold your breath. I never had a press say anything accurate in my life.
Including the New York Times.
I threw that one out, and then I reconsidered it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was hoping so.
Okay, Fox News. This is not Fox News.
Let's move on with the agenda.
Okay, in deference to the time, your staff will save its item and bring up at a later time
There's no federal agencies here to provide informational updates. Your legal counsel had an issue that he wanted to bring up, but he'll save it for your November meeting regarding our Open Meeting Act laws. The last item is the announcement of future meetings. If you notice, we also have put together a draft schedule for 2006 with different locations. Some, there's two sites listed. That'd be your selection. Or if you have another one, you know, you can let us know. The last four, the August, October, November, and December meetings, those locations are set in statute, and those meetings have to occur within the first 10 days of the month, and that's when we start dealing with your sport fish regulation review. So if there's any proposed changes to any of the other locations or dates, let me know. And we would like to have the commission consider adoption of your schedule for 2006 at the November meeting so we can start finding meeting locations and get the schedule on our webpage. Is there any questions or anything the commissioners would like to bring up at this time? If not, I think that conclusion. That was the board. No, the Board of Forestry indicated.
They'd rather go there.
Well, there's a new conference center there, and so if we didn't do Lake Tahoe, we might be able to do...